It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Fat delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
It is a supersized sound of here for Super Bowl Sunday, February 4th, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. This is episode 533 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off. The big game is tonight. I'll throw my prediction in there. Patriots 28, Eagles 20. I'm sorry, all the Eagles fans out there. But yeah, I'm going with the Patriots simply because if I had money down on this game, and I don't, but if I did, Tom Brady is the last person I would ever bet against. I just think that's a foolish thing to be doing. So I think it'll be close, but I think the Patriots get the win. Hey, this Monday, tomorrow, WWE is dropping a batch of nearly 40 Coliseum home videos in the vault section on the WWE Network. It'll be under the title WWE Home Video Classics in the vault section. Now, I talked about this last week, that this was the latest report. The rumor was that February 5th was going to be this big dump, this big drop of old Coliseum videos on the network. It sounded like it was going to be the earliest videos. And so I ran off a list of what the names of a lot of them would be. And we've since found out that they are, in fact, not going to be in order. It will not be the first 40 or so in order like I thought it would be. It's actually a mix. Some of them going back to, you know, as early as 1985, all the way up through videos as late as 1993. WWENetworkNews.com has the full list. You can find it there. They broke the news. Or you could just wait. I'm just going to pop up on the network tomorrow anyway. They include a bunch of WrestleFest videos. WWE did a whole bunch of those back in the day. So the WrestleFest videos from the early 90s are on there. UK Rampage 92 and World Tour 92, both of which include WWF title matches between Randy Savage and Shawn Michaels. So that's going to be on there. And the famous Smack 'em Whack 'em tape, which I have on VHS, although I no longer have a VCR to actually play it. But the box looks nice. But that's the video that has the Bret Hart-Shawn Michaels ladder match for the Intercontinental title from the summer of 92 and the Bret Hart-Ric Flair WWF championship match from a few months later. That was the match where Bret in Saskatoon won his first WWF title. So some really cool stuff dropping on the network this week in that section. If you are into the old school WWF stuff, starting tomorrow, you could definitely start going through those videos. Hopefully I'll be able to find some time this week to check some of them out. Thank you to everybody who's been continuing to take advantage of our Audible trial. The link is still there for you to get yourself a free book if you would so choose to do so. Audibletrial.com/Sala Monster here for 2018. We have our special offer continuing for all of you. If you want to cash in on a free audiobook, all you have to do is punch in that link, sign up for the free trial. You get 30 days to sample the service. You get one free audiobook as part of your trial. You get to keep it no matter what, even if you cancel the trial before it's over. The book belongs to you. You guys know the drill. Audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. And if you've already used one of the trials yourself, use one of your credit cards, whatever, share the link around. If you have a friend, or a Facebook friend, a family member, somebody you think might be able to get something out of it, by all means, let them know about the link and they could take advantage of the offer as well. If you want to become a PayPal VIP, the place to do so is thesalamonster.com. PayPal button is always parked right there on the right-hand side of the page. It is waving to you. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. Really quick, want to run through roll call here. All the people who don't have to, but they are kind enough to show their support every week, and I love the hell out of them for it. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird Brian Pissera, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Brett Brickfist Brode, Massgrave Micah Harshaw. You can check out his Movies, a podcast, which is up on YouTube, youtube.com/Micah Harshaw. The DC Slayer, Marcus Cross, Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog, The Show Off, Corey Van Dam, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, John, more money, more problems. Morin, the German assassin. Trust, Sekepduana. Boy, I hope I pronounced that right. Faith, Hard Knocks, Harvey, Stephen Foulmouth Fowler, Joe, Armbar Armenta Jr., the Harley Davidson, Juan Diaz, Russell the Muscle. We also have Texas Tough, CJ Harp, who I understand is celebrating a birthday today, or at least that's what I'm told by his better half, Sarah. So happy birthday to CJ. The two of them host their own podcast called Wrestling With My Girl, which you can find on Podbean. And last but not least here, Kevin McCarron, who wanted to highlight a GoFundMe campaign for a friend of his by the name of John Malone. John is a singer based here in New York who was recently diagnosed with a nasty condition called vascular necrosis, which basically impedes blood flow to certain parts of the body. He will need a bilateral hip replacement at a cost of $100,000. Isn't the medical system here wonderful? So they're off to a good start here in this campaign. If you would like to help, you may do so by visiting GoFundMe.com, and you can search for John's Hips Don't Lie. That is the title of the campaign. It should be the first one that pops up, so go ahead. And if you would like to do so, you can support John that way. Big-time shout-out to Zach Holker and our Facebook group for putting together our Royal Rumble pool for the fifth year in a row. The man is a beast. We had over 2,000 entrants for the second straight year, 2,040 to be exact, 68 total pools. Congratulations to everybody who drew number 14. Shinsuke Nakamura won the men's Royal Rumble from the number 14 spot. I had number 7, which turned out to be the NXT champion, who of course never stood a chance of winning, but not a bad pick to pick Andrade Cien Almas, especially the night after he had that classic match with Johnny Gargano. So, as many of you know, the way this works is all of the winners, I guess it's 68 winners, 68 of you who drew number 14 are now put into the Ultimate Rumble pool. And the way that works is I will, live here on the show a little bit later, I will be using a randomizer, my trusty randomizer here, to choose three winners. We'll have a third place winner, a second place winner, and a first place winner, all of whom will get prizes that I'll talk about a little bit later on. And the first place winner will officially be the Ultimate Rumble Pool winner for 2018. So we're gonna do that a little bit later on. Before I get to the NXT review, we'll kind of pause for a few minutes, and I will do the live drawings here on the air, and we'll find out who the winners are. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. Thank you to Wade Keller. He had me back on his podcast this past week, second time this year so far. So if you missed it, you can go back in the archives. We talk SmackDown Live. Show went up on Wednesday morning. So I always enjoy the back and forth with Wade. And thank you to everybody who listens because, you know, when you listen, you're supporting me, you're supporting this show. So I very much appreciate people going back and downloading that. If you missed my Royal Rumble review, I got a Sound Off Extra up on YouTube a few hours after the pay-per-view ended last weekend. And the video did over 500,000 views in its first 24 hours. That is insane. Insane. By far the biggest video I've ever done. Apparently it was trending at one point, which I wasn't aware of until later on. It is now up, last I checked, over 680,000 views. So it'll hit 700K soon enough. So thank you to everybody who took the time not only to watch the video, but give it a thumbs up. I appreciate the hell out of you for it. And yeah, it's just about an hour long, so there's a lot there to go through. If you want my full thoughts on the Rumble, that is the place to go. The final Twitter poll, by the way, that I got up, we had over 5,200 votes. That's like WrestleMania numbers in the Twitter poll. And it was a resoundingly positive response. 91% of you voted thumbs up on the Royal Rumble this year. Only 9% voted thumbs down. I cannot emphasize how huge that is, because for a lot of these WWE pay-per-views, first of all, very few get positive numbers that the way that this show did, but that's a lot of votes. I mean, it's not like, well, we only had 1,000 votes, we only had 500. That's over 5,000 people voting in that poll, and to have a 91% positive rating is a big deal. So this was an overwhelmingly positive show for a lot of you. Just some final Rumble notes here. According to The Observer this week, Dolph Ziggler was, in fact, the first choice to be Bobby Roode's opponent in the U.S. Title Open Challenge because of fucking course he was. What did I say last? The stupidest thing they could have done, I said, was have Dolph Ziggler be the mystery opponent. Because what sense does that make? He willingly gave up the championship and walked away. Only to what? Come back and challenge for the same title? That would be dumb. So naturally, that was going to be their first choice. Then they changed their mind. It was going to be Adam Cole. And then they sort of came to their senses and probably realized, well, we don't want to beat Adam Cole. He just lost the night before to Aleister Black. We'll put him in the Rumble. And they settled, unfortunately, they settled on Mojo Rawley. So, you know, I do think it was better to put Cole in the Rumble. The problem is, they didn't really have anybody of note on standby as a choice. So when Mojo came out, I mean, you can practically hear the groans, right? Talk about a disappointing surprise. And Cole, by the way, in the Rumble match, he had a nice little run for himself before he got tossed out by Rey Mysterio. But Dolph Ziggler, I hate to keep harping on this guy, but Dolph Ziggler coming out at number 30, just a complete and total waste of a spot. You know people, when you get to the end of the Rumble, you know people are waiting. They're expecting hopefully something special or a big name or something in the number 30 spot. It's just, you know, sort of the expectations I think that people have now. But look, even if it was Dolph, you know, what they did with him, he came out, and, which I figured he might come out of the Rumble and not bother with the U.S. title, which he didn't, even though that was apparently the original plan. But I thought, well, you know, is there a chance this guy might win? Is there a chance that Dolph Ziggler might come out as a surprise, maybe a number 30, and actually win the Royal Rumble? How would I feel about that? And part of me was like, well, that would be different. It would be a few years too late, but it certainly would be interesting. I can't say I'd be overly excited by that. I certainly would not pick him over Nakamura. But he was in there for 90 seconds and got tossed out like a sack of garbage, and that was it. Didn't make an impact at all, didn't set anything up with anybody as far as any kind of feud going forward. There was no purpose to him even coming out. It was just incredible. I mean, I guess it isn't, you know, the way that he's been booked over the years. But I thought that was a total waste of a spot. The Brock Lesnar and Braun Strowman stuff, some people were upset that I didn't talk more about that. Yeah, the infamous spot at the beginning of the triple threat match at the Rumble, I sort of glossed over it in my review. Look, the reality is this. Everybody knows what Brock Lesnar is all about. Whether you like it or not, you condone it or not, this is a guy that WWE, Vince McMahon, got in a room with Brock and Randy Orton and maybe one or two other people, maybe Triple H, very few people. And they concocted this plan for Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam a couple of years ago to go out there, or maybe it was last year. I don't even know at this point. It might have been last year, but to go to SummerSlam against Randy Orton and legitimately beat the crap out of this guy. Cut him open, make him bleed. Meanwhile, he may have concussed Randy Orton. It was a stupid, dangerous thing to do. But the company knew exactly what they were doing. That was the plan. So, you know, everyone all up in arms, Brock can't get away with this. Of course he's going to get away with this. This is a company that basically greenlit him going out and beating the shit out of not only just another wrestler, but one of their top guys. I mean, Orton agreed to go along with it. I hope they paid him well. But, you know, so if you expect that the company's going to somehow come down on Brock for what he did or anything, you're out of your mind. You know, the fact is, Braun connected with a very well-placed knee to the side of Brock's face, the temple, early in the match, just rammed him in the head, rocked him for a second there with a knee. Brock gave him a receipt. Now, do I condone when somebody gets accidentally kneed to go and full force ball their fist up and punch somebody in the side of the head? I don't. I wouldn't condone that. It was an accident. Accidents happen. One more of those punches, I think Braun would have gone out. I mean, Braun was rocked. I mean, he was woozy for a few minutes after that. He wasn't really right for a good part of that match. And Brock yelled at him, you know, slow the fuck down. So, you know, Brock felt he had to bring him down a peg and sort of teach him the way things really are here, which is kind of funny, you know, given the way that Brock throws people around. That he would be so upset that somebody, you know, connected with a stiff shot. There is a bit of irony in that. But you know what you get with Brock. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a surprise. So when you go in there, you got to be careful. It's just the way it is. And if the company is okay with it, then hey. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say that Brock should be suspended. Brock is not the one who the issue is with here. The issue is with the company. Yeah, they've allowed this sort of thing to go on for a long time. They seem to be perfectly comfortable with it. They let him get away with a lot of different things. You want to get upset about this? You want to blame somebody? Blame WWE. Blame Vince McMahon. But it was a receipt. It happens. Believe me, I'm sure it happens a lot more than we even know. This time it was very noticeable because Brock punched him right. I mean, he punched him right in the head as hard as he could. How could you not notice that? But, you know, again, it goes to the culture of the company, I think, that they would just allow something like that to happen. And, you know, if you have an issue with it, don't direct your anger so much at Lesnar. I mean, he is who he is. Direct your anger at the company. Let them know how you feel about it, if you feel that strongly. I mean, I'm sure Braun, yeah, he didn't feel too good, but I doubt that he went backstage and complained to anybody. And I doubt that he'll knee somebody that hard in the head ever again. You know, sometimes you got to be knocked back down to earth. Maybe not so violently, but, you know, it happens. So that's why I didn't talk much about it. There really isn't much to say. You want my thoughts on it? That's how I feel. You know, it didn't look like a fun thing for him to go through. But that's just part of what, you know, part of what the deal is here. These are big dudes that are going in there and they're throwing knees and they're throwing kicks and they're throwing fists. And things are going to happen and guys are going to pay other guys back. Simple as that. As far as the Royal Rumble matches themselves, the two surprises who looked the best, I thought, like they hadn't aged a day since the last time we saw them, were Rey Mysterio, who, if anything, looked younger and in far better shape than the last time we saw him in Lucha Underground. He was moving around in there like he was 10 years younger. And it's not like he's been sitting at home for months on end. You know what I mean? This guy's working. He's working shows in different promotions in Mexico, in different countries. He's wrestling a lot more, I think, than people probably would have expected at this stage of the game. And, hey, knock on wood, he hasn't had any, apparent knee injuries or anything like that. I mean, this guy's knees are seemingly made of rubber bands, and he's been able to stay healthy. So he looked great. And the other person was Beth Phoenix, the Glamazon. She looked exactly the same from just her face to her gear, to her body, just everything. It's like she stepped out of a time warp from 2008. I thought she looked great. And that's to take nothing away from Trish Stratus, who I also thought looked like she could come back and wrestle a few matches during the year if she wanted to. I'd be game, frankly. I mean, for a Trish Stratus and Sasha Banks feud, or a Trish Stratus and Becky Lynch feud, Trish Stratus and Asuka at some point. If Trish was willing to come back for a few matches during the year, a WrestleMania match, she could still go. I'd love to see her come back for a few matches. Asuka and Shinsuke Nakamura were your Royal Rumble winners. They were the obvious choices. I honestly didn't think WWE would go for two Japanese stars winning both Rumbles. I just didn't think they would do it. I'm glad they did. I can't even imagine seeing that even 5 years ago, let alone, 10 or 15 years ago. And I like them also reviving the old concept of the Rumble winner being able to choose which champion they want to go after at WrestleMania. That does make things a lot more interesting, and it opens up a lot more possibilities, I think, when it comes to people crossing over from one brand to another heading into WrestleMania. It makes the finish a little more unpredictable, too. When you open up more possibilities and more options, all of a sudden, let's say if people thought Roman Reigns or John Cena was going to win the Rumble, well, maybe not. Some people were wondering, well, maybe Finn Balor. Maybe they'll throw him a bone, he'll win, but then cash in against AJ, and he'll go to SmackDown and wrestle AJ Styles at WrestleMania. So all of a sudden, guys who people really weren't giving much of a chance going into the show, people online were talking about them like, hey, this guy might have a shot. Maybe they'll do this. Maybe he'll cross over to this brand. So, and you could have done that, by the way. You could have had Balor win to set up a rematch from a few months ago with AJ Styles. He already beat AJ once, right? Think about this in terms of storyline. If you're Finn Balor and you win the Royal Rumble, and you have the choice of going up against Brock Lesnar or AJ Styles, who you already beat once, who do you think he's going to choose? So the story could be, he already beat the guy once. He knows he could beat him again. Now Balor has the club with him, Anderson and Gallows. We know they have a relationship with AJ. How does that play into things? I think it could have made for an interesting program going into WrestleMania. Here's another wild thought, and people may think I'm crazy, but you want NXT to be looked at as a really big deal? You could have had somebody like Aleister Black, who was my pick. I admit, I knew going in it was a long shot, but when I saw Almas and I saw Adam Cole, I was pretty shocked that they didn't have Aleister Black come out. I guess they just didn't want to beat him. But I thought for sure he was coming out. Maybe not winning, but I thought he was coming out, and he never did. But you could have somebody like an Aleister Black or a big name from NXT enter as a surprise, win the Rumble, and then swerve everybody and claim an NXT championship match WrestleMania weekend in New Orleans instead of choosing the champion on Raw or SmackDown to fight at WrestleMania. Now, that would have been a tougher sell because who in their right mind would turn down the chance to headline WrestleMania, right? For an NXT title match the night before. Point is, though, that by adding the stipulation, you've got a lot more options. So I hope they keep that for next year. I saw the WWE 24 special on the network after the Rumble aired, the one on last year's WrestleMania in Orlando. That was great stuff. I highly recommend it if you haven't watched it yet. The most telling footage to me, and it was cool to see and hear The Undertaker as just Mark Calloway, out of character, before the match, after the match that he had with Roman Reigns, just talking like a regular human being. But the one part that really stuck with me was the scene that they showed before the match, as he was getting ready, as Undertaker was, you know, walking around backstage and just preparing and getting himself psyched up. They're backstage, and Undertaker is walking, and he's just hobbling along. This is before the match even took place. He's limping and hobbling along backstage. He's grimacing like he's in pain. He walked over to Jim Ross, and then they cut away to the next scene. But this only cemented my belief that 33 needs to be the final time we ever see him in his gear. I mean, he made the same comment in this. How about this? He made the same comment in this documentary that he made in that Michael Landsberg interview. Remember that clip I played a few weeks ago? Only a few weeks ago, I played a clip on this show from an interview that he did with Landsberg on his On the Record show in 2002, where he talks about, I don't want to become a shell or a parody of myself. Hope, you know, I'll know when to get out, unlike some of these other guys. And at the time, he was sort of alluding to Hulk Hogan. He wouldn't say it, but you know, Hogan had just come back, and Hogan was old, and people were saying that about Hogan. So I'm sure he was sort of alluding to him, and I don't want to end up that way. And that was in 02. Okay? He said the same thing here in this documentary. Now, when he said it 16 years ago, it wasn't so sad. To see him make the same comment here all these years later, and see the lack of self-awareness. Because in his mind, I guess he thinks that everything's all hunky-dory. Yeah, I'm a little beat up, but I'm still the same guy. And hopefully I never get to that point where people are saying, man, he overstayed his welcome. It's the lack of self-awareness that I thought was really sad. Now you add to that, and I posted a link to this in the Facebook group, WWENetworkNews.com, ran a little exclusive on their website with a screen cap. Not the actual video. I think the clip that was leaked has since been taken down. So I didn't see the video, but I did see the screenshot from the documentary that was cut. But they described a deleted scene from this documentary. And it was cut for whatever reason. They had second thoughts about airing it. It's about a minute-long scene showing Undertaker backstage at WrestleMania last year laying down in the trainer's room, receiving a pain relief injection in his knee. They're just sticking this giant needle right into his leg. And I guess in the clip, he also is talking on camera about, you know, I have to do things like this to give the fans the best performance that I can possibly give. Like, I'm at the point now, basically saying I'm at the point now in my career. I can't just go out there and wrestle, even once a year. I have to lay down here and I have to have them shooting me up with all this stuff just so I can get through the match because the fans have certain expectations of me and I can't let them down. Now, I'm sure tons of wrestlers over the years have done similar things. I mean, for God's sake, Sabu. I mean, I know he's an extreme example, no pun intended, but I mean, you think about Sabu in ECW and the stories of him tearing his body up and using super glue to close the wounds and staple guns. And then, I mean, that guy was out of his mind. But even Undertaker, Triple H has told the story back in the mid-90s when he was still new to the locker room and he would see the Undertaker, who had busted up ribs. He didn't take time off. He put a flak jacket on and he went out there. Friggin' Mabel sat on this guy's face. Okay? By accident. And fractured his orbital bone. Undertaker had to wear a mask. I mean, maybe he took a few weeks off. I don't know if he had surgery or not. I would imagine he probably did. But they had to fit him with this Phantom of the Opera-looking mask that looked completely ridiculous. And he went out there and worked. So I can use Undertaker himself as an example of this over the years. The guy, he's a workhorse. He's a monster. And again, it's not just wrestlers. I mean, football players, other athletes, and other sports do this. But those athletes in other sports, they're not usually 52 years old. They're not usually playing the game for 30 years. Or over 30 years, in The Undertaker's case. And I know it's only one match a year at this point, but the man has nothing left to prove. I mean, I have nothing but respect for The Undertaker. I don't hate The Undertaker. I'm a fan more of his matches in the second half of his career, probably, than the first. And I hear that and I just think to myself, that's so sad. Because in his mind, this is what I have to do for you. This is what I have to do for the fans. Well, I'm a fan. I'm a fan. And I'm sitting here telling you, you don't have to do that. And I know I'm not the only one who feels that way. You don't have to. You have nothing left to prove. Now, he didn't confront John Cena at Raw 25. He was not in the Royal Rumble match. Apparently, he was there backstage because his wife was in the Women's Rumble. But he didn't come out for that. I'm hoping that the Undertaker-John Cena rumor for WrestleMania this year ends up being just that. Just a rumor. And that we have seen the last of him in the ring. This documentary just drove that point home for me. That being said, the entire thing was really well done. They also show the Hardys being snuck into the stadium before their big return, right up to the minute they walk out on stage. It's just great stuff. So I guarantee you this. I guarantee you the 24 special that they're working on right now for Raw 25 will be 10 times better than the actual Raw 25 show. Barstool Sports this week reported what freelance writer Brad Shepard had already reported on Twitter back in November, which is that WrestleMania will be returning to MetLife Stadium in New Jersey next year. So another New York, New Jersey WrestleMania, only 6 years after the last one. This has yet to be confirmed, by the way, by WWE. This is not official. They have not made their big announcement. They have not had a press conference or anything about this yet. So until it's official, it ain't official. But they say in this story that it is a done deal. And if it is a done deal, if it is coming back to MetLife again 6 years later, all I can say is, you know, at least I'll save money. I don't have to fly anywhere, and I get to sleep in my own bed, so I guess that's good. But you guys know I was a little disappointed when I started hearing rumors about New York and New Jersey because, I mean, I use Mania as like my main vacation. I use Mania as an excuse for me to get the hell out of New York every year and go somewhere, usually someplace I've never been before. And I've had the chance to go to Miami, I've had the chance to go to New Orleans and Texas and California and all these places that I've never been to before. I had been as far west as Portland on business. I had never been to California before I went to Mania when it was in Santa Clara a few years ago. So for me, it's not even about the WrestleMania card. And I know I'm not the only one probably who does this, who, you know, gets together with a bunch of friends and goes to WrestleMania. And it isn't so much about WrestleMania. Like, you hope for a good WrestleMania. You don't want to sit through a dud of a show. But there's so many different things going on that weekend. And if you go to a place like in New Orleans, which, you know, when we went a few years ago, I had the time of my life there. You have so much fun hanging with not just your own friends, but just other wrestling fans. We have our meetup, you know, for the podcast. There's other wrestling shows that weekend, NXT, Ring of Honor. They have WrestleCon, all these different things. It's almost not even about WrestleMania at this point. It's about all those other things. So that's why I enjoy going. But it's my excuse to get the hell out of New York. So if they are coming back to New York, that's cool and all. And we'll come up with a fun place somewhere in the city to have a meetup in the whole nine yards. But I'll probably use the Royal Rumble as my vacation next year when they go to Phoenix. which is another place I've never been to before. Although somebody did float this idea to me. They did say, hey, why don't you just go to Wrestle Kingdom instead? And I was intrigued by that thought. I don't think I could do that and the Rumble in the same month. In fact, I know I can't, but I would really like to at some point visit Japan. And I don't even care if it's the Tokyo Dome, if it's one of those smaller venues, Cork and Hall, or, you know, Sumo Hall, or one of those places where they run New Japan shows. Just one day, I'd love to be able to go, you know, to one of those shows. I hear it's a 5-star trip, Japan, I'm just saying. But at some point, hopefully, I'll be able to make it over there. Now, according to the story, Detroit and Philadelphia both were under heavy consideration. New York, though, has won out. So I guess that means SummerSlam will have to find a new home next year, because I can't see them running New York or the New York area for WrestleMania and then coming back a few months later to do SummerSlam. Even I would say that's, you know, very unfair to everybody else. Might I suggest another United Kingdom SummerSlam? I throw that out there as a possibility. Some announcer moves to share here. First, Jonathan Coachman, who made a cameo on Raw 25 last week. He is now back full-time with WWE as their color guy. Quite literally, their color guy. On Monday Night Raw, he has replaced Booker T, who is back in his old role now as a panelist on the pay-per-view kickoff shows. This was Coach's first week on Monday. I thought he was fine. I mean, even Booker didn't. Everyone would always complain to me about Booker. The thing about Booker is he was entertaining. You know what I mean? And he would make mistakes, and then Corey would correct him, or Cole would correct him, and they would laugh, and they would kind of mock him for it. I think after a while, it just became shtick, honestly. It just sort of became part of the act. I thought it was kind of endearing in a way. But, you know, look, it was entertaining. There isn't a whole lot about these announcers sometimes that I could say is entertaining about them. So I didn't mind him as much as other people seemingly did, but I thought Coach did fine. I think he'll be, he's kind of got some personality. He was dropping some sports references, and Cole at one point was kind of, I think it was during the women's match, he was talking about football or the Super Bowl, and him and Corey started to talk about it, and Cole was like, why don't we focus on the match? He was kind of getting snippy. I don't know if that was some directive from the back, like, hey, get him back on point here. Believe me, it won't take very long, I think, for Coach to sort of be retrained in a way to how things are done with the WWE announcing. And so whatever personality he actually does have may not be able to shine through quite as much. But for the first week, I thought he did fine. He wasn't, you know, terrible or anything like that. And the other big move, and I call this an announcer move, but, you know, to my knowledge, I don't know that they've brought him in this role. But it's a move that shocked the hell out of me. I will say that. WWE this week hired Jeremy Borash to work for the NXT brand. One of the last of the TNA originals. This guy was the second employee ever hired by the company after it launched in 2002. And of all the TNA departures, I think this one might be the most demoralizing. This guy did a ton of different things for them over the years. I don't know lately, like the last 6 months or a year, exactly how much stuff he was doing behind the scenes. I've read in a few places where, you know, there were TNA people who were saying, well, it's kind of overblown. He really wasn't doing as much as he used to. Fact is, though, he wore a lot of different hats over the years for that company. He was an on-camera performer. He was an announcer. He would do stuff for their social media and the website. He was, you know, doing different production things and editing for them behind the scenes. So, sort of a renaissance man in a way for that company, doing a lot of different things. And he was kind of part of that heart and soul. You know, when I think of the heart and soul of TNA, I think of people like him. I think of people like Abyss, who is still there. Maybe a handful of other names I'm not thinking of right now off the top of my head. But AJ Styles, I would have said, was part of the heart and soul of that company as well. And that got ripped out of its chest a few years ago when he left. And that was a whole debacle. The fact that they allowed him to go is just... And you see the success that he's had since leaving TNA. It's not like he left TNA and ended up in obscurity here. AJ left. He had a lot of success in New Japan. He's had a ton of success in WWE. He's about to headline, or at least be in one of the top matches at his, you know, for the first time at a WrestleMania. So I think AJ's done very well for himself since leaving there. But Borash, you know, maybe to a lesser extent, was part, I think, of that heart and soul of that company. And it's another little piece that now is chipped away. We've heard a lot of names leaving the company recently. EC3, Bobby Lashley. It just feels like we hear about new defections with this company every week because they don't have the money to pay them what they used to be paid. And they're going through yet another, you know, reorganization phase. Reorganization phase number, 27 here, it feels like, for this company. Hopefully this time it'll stick, right? But it's another little piece of TNA's soul that sort of gets chipped off here. Now, he was seen backstage visiting, or what he claimed he was visiting, friends at the WWE shows in Philadelphia last weekend. Obviously, he was doing a little bit more than just visiting. He wasn't letting on why exactly he was there. This was not an Impact decision. This was not a case where Borash was paid too much and they couldn't come to a deal, so they cut him loose, or they fired him. We don't need you anymore. This was a Borash decision. And it sounds like it sort of caught them by surprise. In fact, it wasn't until last Sunday that I think he even told them that he was leaving. He was their lead announcer. You know, in addition to whatever other duties he may have had behind the scenes, he was their play-by-play guy. And he also played a key role in the production of the Broken Universe stuff with the Hardys, the filming and the editing of a lot of the segments from the Hardy compound. I believe Vanguard 1, the Vanguard 1 drone that they used, is actually owned by Borash. I think that belongs to him. So you would think now that he's in the fold in WWE, and Matt has said in interviews that WWE is absolutely going to do segments from, you know, my house, and we're going to do more segments like Final Deletion and stuff. He said that. You wonder if maybe Borash will have a hand in that. Now, as of right now, that's not why they brought him in. In fact, it doesn't even sound like he's going to have anything to do with the main roster. He's a Triple H hire. Triple H brought him in. I guess there were enough people in Triple H's ear singing this guy's praises that he finally decided to hire him and bring him in. So it doesn't sound like he's into work with the Hardys. He's into work with NXT. In what capacity, I don't know. Could he end up as a backstage interviewer on camera doing stuff? It's possible. I mean, I know they have pretty much all women, all the bots backstage, you know, performing that role, but they could do that with him. Or he could just end up being in a behind-the-scenes capacity. But it's a blow to Impact. I mean, I don't know. Look, I don't have my finger on the pulse of what the TNA universe over there feels about this move. They probably just are making excuses and saying, he wasn't really a big deal anymore anyway. We don't need him. But it's a blow. It's a blow to Impact. Less, I think, for his actual role and more, just for who he was and as long as he has been there for. And now they have to find a new announcer. If nothing else, it's a blow because they have to find a new play-by-play guy. Now, you know, here you have basically one of their longest tenured guys bailing. His decision, he bails for WWE. And it leaves Impact in a lurch because they just did an angle with Josh Matthews. And people were like, yes, finally, Josh Matthews is off commentary, right? They did this angle where Josh Matthews was going to be doing stuff as an on-air performer and not as a play-by-play announcer. And there were rumors that they were going to pair off Borash with Don Callis. Now, Don Callis, of course, has been brought in. He and Scott D'Amore are the two key point people, I guess, kind of leading the charge with the new Impact now. And Callis wasn't going to be like an on-air authority figure or anything like that, but they were probably going to have him be the color announcer with Borash. Well, now Borash is gone, so what do you do? I see reports now that perhaps Kevin Kelly might be brought in, if he's interested, to fill Borash's role, and they could potentially still bring Callis in, and they could put Kelly and Callis together. Now, the two of them work as the English announced team for New Japan Pro Wrestling. And if this happens, I actually think it's a plus. I think it's a good thing for Impact if things work out this way. And I have no idea what Kevin Kelly is thinking about all this, if he's even interested in going to work for Impact. I would think there's a pretty good chance, given the Don Callis connection, that he might be able to bring his friend in. But I happen to like the two of them a lot when I listen to them on those New Japan shows. And I like Kevin Kelly and Steve Corino, too. But if Impact can sign Kevin Kelly to be their play-by-play guy and pair him off with Don Callis, I think that would be a good decision on their part. The Dudley Boys were officially announced for the WWE Hall of Fame class of 2018 this week. Big Daddy Dudley would be proud. WWE.com, I see, recognize them as 17-time tag team champions with titles from, and this is me editorializing now, but that would have to include titles from ECW, WCW, WWE, and even though they were never in WCW. It's like the Hardy Boys, I think, once won the WCW tag team titles on TV, so they're recognized, I think, as WCW tag team champions, but the whole thing is just bullshit because they were never in WCW. It's like Rock being a WCW champion. It sounds ridiculous. But anyway, that includes titles from ECW, WCW, WWE, and New Japan Pro Wrestling. They've had some stints over in Japan as well. So I don't think anybody can deny the fact that these guys are Hall of Famers. Some people would say they're the greatest tag team of all time. I don't know that I would go that far. I'd have to think a little bit if I was going to rank them. Obviously, LOD would be in the conversation because at their peak, you know, in the late 80s, there's a reason that there's an expression called the Road Warrior Pop. I mean, those guys were unstoppable for a while. Those guys were larger-than-life pro wrestlers. Like, if you think about the mold of what a pro wrestler, like, used to be, maybe not so much now, you think of guys like the Road Warriors. I mean, these mean-looking guys with face paint and spiky shoulder pads coming out and beating the crap out of people. That's what pro wrestling was all about. And believe me, I get emails from all the time from people, you know, so sad and depressed now of what wrestling has become. All these midgets, all these, you know, we need real men in these roles. Believe me, there's a lot of people out there like that. And I don't know how much of that is just them sort of waxing nostalgic and how much of that they actually, you know, believe in. But the Dudleys are in the conversation. There's no doubt about it. One of the best teams of all time, stick together, you know, with different promotions is kind of a rare thing for as long as they've done this. They've had their Team 3D Academy now for, I think, like probably like a decade or so. They've had that school. They've been training people. So they've made their mark. They've earned their place, I think, in the Hall of Fame. As far as who inducts them, see, this is what's so weird to me about the rumor of Paul Heyman being the one to induct Goldberg. And that hasn't been confirmed yet, but that was a report from a few weeks ago. And it just doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, somebody like DDP or Eric Bischoff should be the one inducting Goldberg into the Hall of Fame. Because, especially Bischoff, Bischoff can speak to the genesis of the whole Goldberg character. It was under his watch that Goldberg took off as this megastar, the biggest star WCW ever created, maybe ever. I know Sting had more longevity than he did, but let's be honest here. At their peak, Goldberg was a much bigger star, I think, than Sting was. But if it's not Goldberg, if he's not A1, he's A2. And I think somebody like Bischoff can speak to that. Paul Heyman would make a lot more sense to induct the Dudley Boys because it was under his watch that the Dudleys were created and the Dudleys became stars in ECW who eventually went on to become Hall of Famers. So would it not make more sense for Paul Heyman to be the ones to induct the Dudleys? If not Heyman, I think somebody like Tommy Dreamer. I know he and Bubba love to go at each other a lot on social media, but I think Tommy Dreamer would be another good choice to bring him in and induct those guys. So either one, I think, would do fine as an inductor. But we'll see. Now, I'll label this under potential spoilers. If people don't want to hear other potential names who may be going in this year, you could skip ahead by a minute. But two other names that are rumored to be going into the Hall of Fame are Ivory. And Ivory was a name, I think, that was dropped a few months ago. So it sounds like she's all but in. And Bam Bam Bigelow, by the way, is a name that was dropped a few months ago as well. I haven't heard his name mentioned lately, so I don't know if things have changed or not. But at one point, apparently Bam Bam was supposed to be one of the inductees this year. But a new name that I had not heard that was mentioned this week, I believe by PW Insider, was Mark Henry, who has not been seen on WWE television now for a number of months. And I think it was Meltzer in his newsletter a few weeks ago kind of mentioned that he's pretty much retired. And Henry came out on Twitter and like disputed, like he was offended by this. Like, I'm not retired, you know, fake news or whatever. But boy, you know, the fact that he hasn't wrestled on TV in so long, and if he goes into the Hall of Fame this year, I don't know, that sounds like somebody who's retired to me. And Mark Henry also deserves his spot in the Hall of Fame. There's going to be people who say Mark Henry is not a Hall of Fame worthy, you know, name. And to those people, I would submit this. What is the criteria for going into the WWE Hall of Fame? Tell me what the criteria is. You can't, because there is none. There is no criteria for the WWE Hall of Fame. Literally anybody could go into the WWE Hall of Fame. Drew Carey is in the WWE Hall of Fame. Vince McMahon's father's driver is in the Hall of Fame. I'm sure he's a nice guy. I'm sure he played his part. Should he be in the Hall of Fame? No. But it's not my Hall of Fame. It's not your Hall of Fame. It's Vince McMahon's. It's in the mind of Vince McMahon. Literally anybody could go into the Hall of Fame. You can come up with any reason for any one of these guys to go into the Hall of Fame. Mark Henry is a guy who you don't have to struggle too much with. Yes, he had a lot of issues early with injuries in his career. He never really achieved the heights I think that they would have hoped. He came in with like a big $10 million 10-year contract that probably pissed a lot of people off when they signed him in 96. He came in with a lot of money and a lot of fanfare, and he fizzled out pretty quick. And how many incarnations of Mark Henry from Sexual Chocolate? Then he became, I think they paired him off with Teddy Long at one point. And then finally, years and years later, we get the Hall of Pain version of Mark Henry, who takes off on SmackDown as a headliner. It's not until 2011, this guy signed in 1996, it's not until 2011 that this guy wins his first world championship. He beats Randy Orton in two straight pay-per-view matches, mind you. Pins him right in the middle of the ring. Orton put this guy over big time. And people, you know, it didn't take a whole lot to buy into the fact that, oh my God, this guy is a badass. You know, I wouldn't want to be on his bad side. They did a tremendous job getting this guy over like a monster, like what Brock Lesnar is today. Right? At that time, that was the year before Brock came back, we had Mark Henry. Mark Henry was the closest thing to a Brock Lesnar type in the latter half of 2011 that we had in the entire company. I can remember skits they did on SmackDown where he would grab, you know, production people backstage and hurl them over, you know, off camera. You wouldn't even see where they landed. I mean, this was not somebody to be trifled with. And he had his catchphrases that he would drop, you know. What was the great line about, you know, paying your bill like for oxygen or something? I forgot what it was. But he was awesome in that role. And unfortunately, what happened? He got hurt. That was the problem that plagued him throughout his entire career. The guy was injury prone. So in the middle of this run that he was having, I do remember him having an absolutely terrible match with Big Show at Survivor Series in 2011, with a terrible finish too. I mean, that was the match where Big Show did the Randy Savage elbow off the top, and then I think Henry kicked him in the balls or something and got DQ'd. I was in the garden that night. Everybody booed the hell out of that finish. But I think he was either hurt at that point, or he got hurt the next month. He had to drop the belt. So his run got cut short, but there was a period of time there where it looked like they might potentially be building to a match, I thought, at WrestleMania in Miami, where if Henry was healthy, he could have held the championship until WrestleMania, and they could have done the underdog story with Daniel Bryan, who had that Money in the Bank, contract at the time. You could have built to a Mark Henry-Daniel Bryan match at WrestleMania for the championship. Like, there was a period of time where it seemed like they were building, or they could build, to something like that. And I never would have thought in my wildest dreams that I ever would have saw Mark Henry as somebody who could potentially headline a WrestleMania as a champion. But that's the level they got him to, even if it was for only a few months. Look, Goldberg's run as champion was not that long. Goldberg won the world title in WCW in what, July of 98? And by the end of the year, he dropped it. He never really recaptured that magic. It really was only for that, you know, a relatively short period of time. You know, and I'm not going to say that Mark Henry was as big of a star as Goldberg was, but he had that momentum only for a few months, and then it got cut short. I would put the guy in the Hall of Fame just for that one promo on Raw back in, what was it, 2013, I think, with the salmon jacket where everybody thought he was retiring. I can remember Coach was working at ESPN, and he even tweeted Coach that afternoon, "Hey, Coach, I'm going to have my retirement speech tonight, or I hope you tune in." Like, he was really laying it on thick, and then he lowered the boom on John Cena. "I have a lot left in the tank," and it was just great. In fact, when I did my list of the top 9 promos in WWE history, that was on the list. I don't remember if it was number 7 or 8 or something in my top 9 all time WWE promos, but it was on the list. So for that promo alone, Mark Henry belongs in the Hall of Fame, and I hope one day when we have a physical Hall of Fame, that jacket is put on display. That jacket, like Archie Bunker's chair, it needs to be in its own glass case on display one day in the Hall of Fame. Now, Raw was in Philly. This past week, we had over 3,100 votes in our poll on Twitter, 67% thumbs up, 33 thumbs down. A day after, Ronda Rousey debuted at the Royal Rumble. Here, we're almost an hour into the show, and I'm first mentioning Ronda Rousey now. Ronda Rousey debuts at the Royal Rumble, and we have all these stories on ESPN and all these different media outlets running headlines saying that she's now a full-time performer in WWE, and the very next night on Raw, she's a no-show. But she had a good reason. She had to fly back to Columbia to finish shooting scenes for her movie, so we can give her a pass on that. I want to talk about this whole situation with the women and the supposed heat that Ronda has and these women going on social media. We heard from Sasha Banks and Nikki Bella and Nia Jax and Dana Brooke, and even Alundra Blaze chimed in on this whole thing. And they were all very upset that Ronda's big moment at the end of the Rumble last Sunday took away from the Women's Royal Rumble match. It took away from Asuka's win. It took away from all the accomplishments that the women have had over the years. Now, I want to believe that they were all just given a directive to talk smack about her to create a buzz, because I find it very hard to believe that all of them would speak out of turn at the exact same time. It was like the day that, like, Nia tweeted something, but it's like all of a sudden everybody else tweeted something, almost like they were told to. You know what I mean? It just seemed a little too convenient for me, a little too well orchestrated. So whether it was orchestrated or they all just chose to do that, you know, on their own to generate a buzz and try to get something going with Ronda, I want to believe that that's all this is. And I think it is. I think this is all just part of them trying to drum up, you know, something to get people talking. But then I'm reminded of all the WWE roster guys who were supposedly upset with The Rock coming back and headlining WrestleMania in Miami against John Cena. It is a business. Look, if I had the chance to bring in Ronda Rousey heading into my biggest show of the year, and I passed on her, I would hope that somebody would throw a burlap sack over my head and drag me to the clinic to have my head examined. I mean, imagine how salty all these women would be if Ronda had actually won the Rumble. I mean, holy shit. Their heads would have exploded. Instead, they saved it for after the Rumble. Ronda came out. Asuka won the Rumble. She was the Royal Rumble winner. She was featured in the opening segment of Raw the very next night, and then got a big win over Sasha Banks later in the show. So Asuka had two segments on the show. Now, both women almost died in the process, but she was the only one that needed to be focused on. I mean, aside from Ronda, who couldn't be there, but Asuka was the one who needed to be focused on coming out of that show, and they did that. They focused on her, so I don't see what the issue is. Now, Natty gave an interview to TV Insider. She did nothing but praise Ronda Rousey. She called her, she's my friend. She said all the other women, regardless of how they felt about the way they debuted her, they all have respect for her. And she said that I can't wait to wrestle her. So finally, somebody with some common freaking sense here. So basically, it boils down to the women. Here's what I think is going on. All of this is probably much ado about nothing, but the women have a legitimate issue with the way in which she debuted. So they don't blame Ronda. They don't hate Ronda. There's photos from after the show. They're all hugging her and taking selfies with her backstage. There's no heat there. The issue, though, that I think is very real is that they didn't like the way that WWE debuted her. And I do think that that's legit. I think that many of them do have an issue with them debuting her when and how they did. Nikki Bella was replying to a fan comment on Instagram, I think it was, or maybe Facebook. She said, "We all love Ronda. It's the booking that made us all so upset. It took away from a very special moment, a moment that took so many years to get to." The booking, she says. That was her word. The booking is what they had an issue with. She sounds like she should have a podcast saying things like that. Now, the only issue that I had with it was the stupid fake pointing that they had her doing. Otherwise, I didn't think that there was a problem at all with the way they debuted her. It was the stupid pointing. She looked as phony doing that as the women do when they're forced to stand next to those monitors backstage. One night in, and they're already making Rousey feel phony when she should be one of the realest things on that show. They need to stop that. Don't do that. With all of their production wizards in the truck who can make the word rock star flash across a screen like they just discovered how to use Adobe Elements for the first time. Okay, with all their production wizardry that they have in that company, you would think that it would be easy enough for them to get a shot of Ronda positioned in the ring with the WrestleMania sign in the background above her or something like that. You can send the same message without having her point to the sign like she's spotted a fucking bald eagle in the sky. So the bottom line is, whatever her first match is going to be, and it's going to be WrestleMania, it's going to be a big deal. And it also might just get the women the main event spot at WrestleMania for the very first time, which would be a good year or two quicker than I thought they would. I figured it's going to happen in the next couple of years. I didn't think it would happen this soon, and maybe it doesn't, but they got a real shot at it this year. I mean, think about it. They are so hung up on this women's revolution stuff. This may be the year. Think about this. In just the last year, we've gotten the first ever women's Money in the Bank match, the first ever women's Royal Rumble match. We're getting the first ever women's Elimination Chamber match. So even if it's a mixed tag and you've got a couple of guys in there, if they headline WrestleMania, it would be the they could say, oh, it's the first time that two women have ever competed in the main event of WrestleMania. You don't think they would do that? You don't think that if they had the chance to do that, they wouldn't jump all over that and promote the hell out of that? Me? I just want the best match to headline the show. The one match that you think has the best chance of just completely wiping out the crowd for everything that follows it. Like Rock and Hogan at 18, which should have gone on last. Or Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker at 25, which should have gone on last. In hindsight, both times poor Triple H got fucked over. And I promise you that will be the last time that you ever hear me use the words poor Triple H. But dude got fucked over. But this year, I think that that match, the match that has the chance to just wipe everybody out and screw everybody over who goes on after them, is AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura. To me, that is the match that should go on last at WrestleMania this year. But between the Ronda stuff and the big dog going for the big red belt, I know the chances are probably better that Styles and Nakamura open the show this year than them closing it. I realize this, but if it were me, that's the match that goes on last. The current rumor is that it's going to be Ronda and a partner against Triple H and Stephanie. The Rock, I've heard The Rock's name mentioned. Obviously, we had that segment of WrestleMania 31 where it was The Rock and Ronda were in the ring. They did that little deal with Triple H and Stephanie where, you know, Ronda grabbed Stephanie by the arm and then Ronda gave Triple H, was it like a hip toss or some kind of takeover? So The Rock would make sense. And look, The Rock's the biggest star in the world right now. So if you can get The Rock for WrestleMania and he's allowed to wrestle, you'd be a fool not to put him in the ring. I can't think of like a big singles match that The Rock would even have time to sort of promote. You know, you can fantasy book, oh, who on the roster do I want to see The Rock against? Honestly, right now, I can't think of one match because it's not like he's going to be around to promote it anyway. But a mixed tag match, yeah, that probably is the best role for him. So The Rock would make sense, and I'm okay with that. Braun Strowman. Why not Braun Strowman in that role? Either one of those guys would make sense, right? Strowman's he's a big star. He is very clearly not going to be the champion and not going for the championship at WrestleMania. It seems pretty obvious to me. And so he's kind of a man without a program going into the biggest show of the year. Now, the rumor is that it's going to be him and Miz for the Intercontinental title. And, you know, I said last week, I'm okay with that idea because it certainly makes that title, it positions that title in a good spot on the show. It would be nice to actually see the IC title defended at WrestleMania. We had this whole stretch for years where 7 or 8 straight years where the belt wasn't even defended on the show. And Miz has had a hell of a year for himself. That would be a big match for him. And it would be a title for Braun to win. It would be a championship for him to win. So I actually don't hate that idea. But if you've got Braun against Miz as one option, or Braun and Ronda Rousey against Triple H and Stephanie as your other option, what do you think you're going to go with? Right? Especially if you want this guy to be positioned as one of the biggest stars you have. I can't think of a bigger match for him I mean, look, they tried to give Bobby Lashley the rub working with Donald Trump in that Battle of the Billionaires all those years ago. And things didn't really work out for Lashley the first time around, but they put him in that role for a reason. They had big plans for him. They thought he was going to be a big star. So let's, you know, pair him off with Trump and we'll have Vince with Umaga and he'll get the rub and we'll have all these eyeballs on him and he'll be a big, big star. So if you want to get eyeballs on this guy, you want to give him the rub, so to speak, it'd be a great role for Strowman. Now, the thing is, it's a tag team match, which I think makes things a little more interesting than a singles match would be with Triple H. I have no interest in seeing Triple H in a singles match against Braun Strowman. I've made that very clear. A mixed tag like this makes things more interesting, so I'd be okay with it. And if Strowman gels with Ronda as well as he's gelling with Alexa Bliss in the mixed match challenge from what I saw this week, hey, I'm all for putting the two of them together. I'll talk about it later, but I thought the stuff with Strowman and Bliss was great that they did on Tuesday. So if he could have even some of that chemistry with Ronda, I think it could end up being a good pairing. Whoever it is, though, I do think a mixed tag is the way to go. And I'll tell you why. There's a few different reasons for this. It limits what Ronda Rousey has to do. She's been training for months now, right? We've heard that she's been sneaking into the PC at night, secret training sessions. It's been going on now for months. But we don't know how good she is. She may be the shits, for all we know. I mean, some athletes cross over and take to it like a duck to water. Some don't. Is she Kurt Angle or is she Mongo McMichael? We don't know. But if she signed on full time, whatever the hell that means, there's going to be plenty of time to build to feuds with Asuka and build to feuds with Charlotte and Sasha Banks. They don't have to rush Ronda's first singles match at this year's WrestleMania. If they've got her long term, save those matches. And here's another reason. If Ronda works a match with Stephanie at WrestleMania, she's going to get cheered, right? I mean, we know this. No one is cheering for Stephanie McMahon over Ronda Rousey. And Stephanie is not going to get any real offense in on Ronda because that would be ridiculous. That's why you do a tag team match. Stephanie can tag in and out very quickly. Maybe she'll get an eye rake in there, distract Ronda. She'll get a shot or two in. She's not going to get a ton of offense in on this woman. In fact, I think part of the draw here is that you want to see Ronda get her hands on Stephanie. And Stephanie, again, she'll tag in at very opportune times and quickly tag out. And she keeps escaping until the very end of the match, which is when Ronda finally gets her hands on her and she taps her out in an armbar. I mean, that's how the match should end. Okay, so, but that, and she'll get cheered and everybody will be happy. Going forward, though, I see Ronda Rousey as a heel. Because here's the thing, I find this woman naturally unlikable. There's just something about her personality I find naturally unlikable. But like in a good way, where I think as a wrestler, she could use that to her advantage. I saw a lot of her fights and how she reacted to losing. She didn't take it very well. But there's just something about her. She comes off as naturally unlikable to me. So going forward, I actually think she could settle in nicely as a heel who's just completely full of herself, thinking she's better than everybody else on the roster. I'm a big star. Nobody can beat me. Just completely self-absorbed. She can be the hero at WrestleMania and get the easy win, but then the turn begins. Let Asuka beat Charlotte for the championship at WrestleMania, because she's wrestling Charlotte. I mean, that has to be the match. We still don't know who Asuka is challenging, but to me, Charlotte is the only option here. Then you can build to Rousey and Charlotte, or Rousey and Banks at SummerSlam in Brooklyn. Me, I would save the Asuka match if they can hold off this long. I would hold off on Rousey and Asuka until next year's WrestleMania. But in the interim, though, between now and SummerSlam, you give her a couple of other women to beat. Maybe Becky Lynch. I mean, that'll get her booed. You put Ronda Rousey up against Becky, the people are going to get behind Becky. I believe that. Becky is very well liked. And she's probably a really good person, honestly, to be in there against Ronda. As far as having her in there with somebody that could probably make Ronda look like $1 million, I think Becky is probably one of the better people you could put in there with her. And you just slowly build her up from there. You give her some wins. Again, you can build to a big match at SummerSlam. It doesn't have to be with Asuka, and you save it. But again, we don't know what full-time means. Does full-time mean Brock Lesnar scheduled? Does full-time mean house shows? What does that mean? I think putting her on TV every single week would be a colossal mistake. I mean, look at the people who write and book for these shows every week. If Brock Lesnar was on TV every week, the guy would mean nothing at this point. And I know there are people that don't like Brock, but you got to admit that when Brock shows up, there's a different vibe. Even after 5 years now he's been back, was it 5 years, 6 years almost? The guy still feels special. That's a miracle. Name me one other person on WWE television who after 6 months, let alone 6 years, feels special anymore. There isn't a single person that I could think of who I honestly think feels special when they come out on TV. And I don't know how good or bad Ronda even is at this. She doesn't strike me as the best talker in the world. What the hell are you going to have her doing on TV every single week? So I can't imagine they're going to put her on TV every week. So what this full-time thing means is still kind of very, I don't know, it's very nebulous here. We still don't know exactly what that means. But I think that's the role for Ronda going forward. I think she should be the heel. The show on Monday, though, had three really good matches, I thought. Miz and Reigns, they had a rematch for the Intercontinental title. Sasha Banks against Asuka, and John Cena against Finn Balor in an Elimination Chamber qualifying match. Speaking of the Chamber, WWE has announced the first ever women's Elimination Chamber match for the next pay-per-view. Now, unlike the men's Chamber match, which is going to determine who goes on to challenge Brock Lesnar at WrestleMania, Alexa Bliss is going to be defending her championship inside the Chamber. And there is local advertising for the show that has this as the, I guess, spoiler lineup here for the Women's Chamber match. It's Alexa Bliss, Nia Jax, Bayley, Sasha Banks, Mandy Rose, and Sonya Deville. And those were the names in the advertising that are listed as the participants. Of course, card is subject to change. Always have to remember that, but I would think, just looking at that lineup, I would think that Bayley would eliminate Sasha, given that Sasha eliminated Bayley from the Royal Rumble match, which they never even mentioned on TV last week. No follow-up, no interaction between them, nothing at all. Bayley wrestled on Main Event, I think, which says a lot about where she ranks in the pecking order right now. I guess it's not her turn, so they really don't know what to do with her, so they have her on Main Event. But this way, you know, if you have Bayley eliminate Sasha from the Chamber, it could set Sasha off. I mean, it seems like they've been teasing more heelish tendencies in Sasha. I don't know if they're going to pull the trigger or not, but this way they can both point to, I screwed you screwed me, out of title opportunities, and maybe they can do an undercard singles match between the two of them at WrestleMania. So I figure the two of them, one way or another, the two of them cancel each other out. Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville are not winning the championship. So that leaves Alexa Bliss and Nia Jax, which I figure is probably the match for WrestleMania. I think Bliss retains in this Chamber match, which is kind of funny because she's probably the smallest person in what is supposed to be this dangerous, sadistic match. And I see her being the one to eke out a win and retain her title. And if she does, she can hold on until WrestleMania. If she can, that is, if she can hold on to that championship until then, she will walk into her first two WrestleMania matches as champion. Last year was her first match at WrestleMania. She walked in as the SmackDown Women's Champion. She lost the title. This year, if she can hold on, she will walk into her second WrestleMania match as the Raw Women's Champion. And probably will also lose the championship. But that's pretty impressive if she can pull that off. Now for the Men's Chamber match, we already have Braun Strowman, who killed Kane, Elias, who pinned Matt Hardy, and John Cena, who pinned Finn Balor in a first-time-ever match. We've gotten a lot of those on TV with John Cena. We had one with him and Nakamura last year. They're just giving these things away like candy, it seems. But he beat Balor in their first meeting. They've all qualified for the Chamber. So we know three of the six names already in the Chamber match. Balor, in his match with Cena, he kicked out of an AA, but I mean, let's be honest here, everybody kicks out of the AA. Cena hit him with a super AA off the ropes, and that was enough for the win. If they plug Strowman in as Rousey's partner against Triple H and Stephanie at WrestleMania, that opens up Balor, I think, to challenge Miz for the Intercontinental Championship. If they don't do Miz and Strowman, you could plug Balor in there, I think, as the number one contender for the IC title of Mania. So Maybe they're going to start something soon with, between the two of them, and that's why Balor lost here. I look at this rumored lineup for this chamber match. You have Elias, Cena, Strowman, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, and likely it was going to be Jason Jordan, but he's got a neck injury that apparently is a lot more serious than originally thought, to the point that he could potentially be out of WrestleMania, let alone the chamber match. So if Jordan is out, and by the way, what terrible timing that is for him, because it looked like they were building to something with him and Rollins for WrestleMania, maybe even something with him and Kurt Angle, and that could be out the window now. So he's got to feel just completely demoralized. You know, the timing could not be worse for him. But if he's out, that means you're down a spot in the chamber match, and that's a spot that really should have gone to Finn Balor. I mean, if we're being perfectly honest here, really, that should have gone to Samoa Joe. But Joe is hurt. I pray they don't put Kane in this match. It looked like they killed him off TV last week, but he's like Jason Voorhees, if Jason was a libertarian. You kill him and they just keep coming back. So it's already been announced for tomorrow night. Roman Reigns is going to challenge Bray Wyatt in a qualifier for the chamber. Gee, I wonder who goes over in that match. We'll get to see the eater of pins tomorrow night. I mentioned Kane being killed off TV. We got yet another attempted murder by Braun Strowman on the show this past Monday. What does that make for the number four for the past year? Five, maybe? I've lost track. This time, he was wrestling Kane in a last man standing qualifying match, which within the first 60 seconds had already spilled over by the announcers by the stage. So he knocks Kane down, and Strowman then proceeds to flip over, not just the announce desk itself, but the entire platform, the entire stage on which the announcer's desk is sitting. He flips the entire structure over onto Kane's dead body. And this was apparently enough to win the last man standing match. We couldn't see the referee counting, but there was a 10-second delay from the moment that Braun overturned the table to the moment the ref called for the bell, so I'll assume he was counting that entire time. They replayed this no less than 10,000 times throughout the entire show. And the thing of it is, when we've seen this man flip over an ambulance, when we've seen this man pull down a giant metal rig onto two other human beings, stuff like this just doesn't seem as impressive. It really doesn't. I'm not sure it warranted so many replays, okay? But Replay-a-mania is what we got. And after taking Kane to a local medical facility, we were later told that he sat up in the emergency room, crawled out of the hospital, and yes, Michael Cole actually used that word, 10 lashes for him. Kane then left the hospital and has not been seen since. Probably called an Uber to the airport. After all this, what I get out of this is this fucking feud is still not over. Strowman keeps trying to murder people every week. I'm kind of hoping he finally succeeds so we could be done with this. Miz and Roman Reigns went almost 20 minutes. Rematch for the IC title. These two worked very well together. I thought they had a real good match. Ended with Miz rolling him up while holding the trunks. This after interference from Bo Dallas and Curtis Axel. In fact, Roman had hit, I want to say it was Axel, with a spear. And that's when Miz rolled him up for the win. Asuka beat Sasha Banks in another long match, one of the best women's matches on Raw in a very long time, even if the crowd didn't seem to really feel it. I did. I thought it was really good. Sasha Banks has done interviews calling herself the greatest women's wrestler of all time. And the good news is that she has a shot to be. If she can have more matches, the quality of this one. The bad news is, she won't be. If she has more matches like this one and keeps landing on top of her head. Or nearly landing on top of her head. You all saw the dive spot by now, I'm sure. Asuka's outside the ring. Sasha Banks dives through the ropes. And I slowed it down. I wanted to see exactly what happened. It's like the Zapruder footage. I'm watching this thing. The problem was she dove too late. That's what happened. She dove too late. And in doing so, basically her torso got caught in the rope a little bit. And that caused her to just fall straight down. Asuka was supposed to throw a kick and I guess hit her in midair. She did throw the kick, and I guess she connected with it. We heard a thwap. She connected with it, even though Sasha was on her way straight down. And on the way down, Sasha's hip struck the ring apron, and that probably saved her from an early retirement. Were it not for that apron, she would have landed right on top of her head and her neck. The apron saved this woman. The announcers shrieked. I shrieked. Mick Foley went on Twitter and said he wants Sasha to take that move off the menu. And if Mick Foley, of all people, thinks you're doing something too dangerous, it's probably a good idea to stop doing that. So Asuka then turns around and says, well, if you could do it, I could do it better. She nearly kills herself, doing a butt bomb dive. Sasha's on the apron. She goes to do her butt bomb thing. Sasha moves out of the way, and Asuka goes right through the ropes. And thankfully for her, she hit the apron too. Otherwise, she would have splatted right on the floor. I mean, she did splat on the floor, but at least she had a cushion from the apron on her way down. How these women didn't kill themselves in this match is a miracle. But they kept going. And Asuka was hitting those hard, spinning back fists and kicks and beating the crap out of Sasha. And in the end, she locked in the Asuka lock and got the tap out. Despite the, you can call them a botch, call them whatever you want, it actually kind of added to the match in a way, to the brutality of this match. But I thought it was a hell of a match, despite the near-death experiences that both women had. I thought this was a hell of a match. And Cena beat Balor in the main event, which I already mentioned. Three really good matches on this show, so you can't argue with that. SmackDown Live was also in Philly. Their fourth straight night in Philly, and it sounded like it. These people sounded exhausted by this point. 1,600 votes in the Twitter poll, 64 up, 36 down. Look, I appreciate them trying new things. I will never fault anyone, let alone WWE, for trying new things. Whether it's a new camera angle, if it's something, some kind of new concept that they come up with. Remember that scramble match they came up with years ago that thankfully they ditched because it was dumb? I won't fault them for trying new things. But these new on-screen graphics that they debuted on Tuesday night, this needs to die. It just needs to die. We don't need the word Rockstar in giant letters flashing across the screen during Nakamura's entrance. We don't need words popping up on screen like I'm watching Adam West beating up bad guys on Batman from the 1960s. The jail cell effect during the Usos promo. Lock it up and throw away the key. Let this be a one-week experiment. Sometimes you test your new drug. They have drug trials, right? Sometimes you test your new drug out on the lab rat, and what happens? The lab rat dies. Sucks for the rat, but hey, it's for the good of mankind. It happens. You tried. Never do this again. Now that's the negative. A positive development from this week's show, because I do try to balance out the negative with the positive, was the announcement by Daniel Bryan of a new SmackDown Top 10 list. Now, you guys have heard me pitch the idea of a ranking system many times before here on the show. Probably a good 7 or 8 years ago is when I first, mentioned it. Something interactive that the fans can follow along with online, because people love that shit. They love following along with numbers and stats and that kind of thing. And something meaningful that plays into the storylines that we see on TV. Not the Power 25 or the Power Rankings, I think it is, that they do now on WWE.com, which don't mean anything. They don't even promote it on TV. I think they're quarterly now. They're not even, every week. I'm talking about something where random people don't just end up in title contention for seemingly no reason at all. There's an actual method to the madness. Guys can leapfrog to a higher spot in the rankings, let's say if they beat somebody who's ranked higher than them. I mean, look, if you have a storyline reason, man, we have these stupid rankings and they handcuff us, man. We have somebody at number 7 that we want to give a title shot to. Well, guess what? It forces you to be creative and find a way to get number 7 and number 1. I want to hold these people accountable. I want them to think harder. That's why I like the concept so much. Yeah, it does sort of handcuff them in a way. It forces them to think things through a little bit more. What's so bad about that? You do a top 10 for your world title, you do a top 5 for every other championship, That was my way of doing it when I first pitched it. What they're doing here is a little bit different. This is how they describe it on WWE.com. The SmackDown Top 10 list is a new way for the superstars on SmackDown Live to show Bryan, Daniel Bryan, and Commissioner Shane McMahon who is most deserving of future opportunities. This week, the men and women of Team Blue will vote on who they think is the best on Tuesday nights. Criteria includes overall talent, locker room leadership, and athletic skill. Bryan did note that there are some ground rules. Neither he nor Shane will be voting, and no superstar can vote for himself or herself. So those are the rules. I do laugh at locker room leadership being one of the main criteria in a top 10 list. Let's be honest here. Once DashaBot gives the order to Skynet, it's not like any of this is going to matter. But so that sounds dumb. But talent and athletic skill, fine. That makes sense. Having it be a wrestler vote, obviously in storyline, having it be a wrestler vote, it's an interesting little twist. I could see some of the heels buttering up the baby faces backstage, trying to curry goodwill for the weekly vote. Maybe Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn start baking a cake for AJ Styles and people. Let's see how it plays out. But based on those three criteria, I'm looking at that. AJ Styles should be number one pretty much every single week going forward. I mean, it's not if we're really judging it on that, it's kind of not even fair. I saw some praise for the talking in the women's segment with Charlotte and the Riot Squad, in particular Ruby Riot's performance. I'll say this much, I think Ruby does very well with the material that she's given. She has a presence about her in a way, you know, when she speaks. She certainly seems a lot more comfortable than Liv Morgan or Sarah Logan do on the microphone. That really is the best I could say about that segment, though. I thought it was just bad up until the Money in the Bank tease with Carmella. So Riot Squad laid out Charlotte after doing some jaw-jacking back and forth. Carmella rushes out with a referee, and she's about to announce that they're cashing in. She's cashing in her Money in the Bank. And then Carmella throws a drop kick at Charlotte. Charlotte moved, and she hit the referee by mistake. Knocks him out of the ring. He lands right on his head. Carmella's screaming at the referee, "Get up! Get up!" Too late. Charlotte's already back up on her feet. Carmella bails. I thought it was a nice little reminder that she still has until June to cash that thing in. You kind of forget sometimes. She's had it for so long. You got to do that. You got to have that tease to remind people every now and then. I thought the Fatal 4-Way to determine a number one contender for the U.S. title was good. We had Rusev winning over Kofi Kingston, Jinder Mahal, and Zack Ryder when he locked Kofi in the accolade for the submission. So Rusev gets his title match on Tuesday. And if ever there was a time to pull something of a double turn, this would be it. I know Bobby Roode gets a good reaction when he comes out. I'm speaking from my perspective. I like him more as a heel. I think he works better as a heel. It just, to me, feels like he's playing a babyface. Like when he was a heel in NXT or even in TNA, you go back to when he split from James Storm, the dirty heel stuff he did with Austin Aries. If you want to go back that far, it seemed to come more naturally to him. He was funny. He was entertaining. But he was good. It seemed like a very comfortable role for him to be in. Rusev, on the other hand, Rusev can play the heel role just fine. There's nothing wrong with him being a heel. He can be kind of the comedic heel. He could be the just dominant Bulgarian brute. You know, when he first debuted, he did that very well. But the people are so into this guy right now, and he's never been positioned as a babyface. In all the years, the 3 or 4 years he's been on the main roster, even going back to when he was Alexander Rusev in NXT, he's never been a babyface. The Rusev stuff, the Rusev Day stuff, just took off. Apparently those calendars they made where literally every day it just says Rusev Day on it, apparently is selling like hotcakes. The guy is entertaining as all hell, and I would love to see him get a shot at it. You know, even if they just start the turn and they don't blow it in one night, this is something I think that could build to a rematch at Fastlane next month. I think that's the next SmackDown pay-per-view. They have a chance here to start something on Tuesday. I hope they don't just blow off Rusev as a one-week challenger to make room for Dolph Ziggler to come back for the championship that he willingly surrendered. I hope that they have a plan here. So, in response to the controversy at the Royal Rumble with AJ Styles, he pinned the illegal man in the handicap match, right, against the Owens and Zayn. This Tuesday, Daniel Bryan announced that Kevin Owens is going to go one-on-one with his best friend, Sami Zayn, And the winner of that match will then challenge AJ Styles at Fastlane for the WWE title. The main event on this show was Owens and Zayn against AJ and Nakamura. There is dissension in the ranks. They're teasing between Owens and Zayn. Zayn actually left in the middle of the match. He bailed twice, two different times. He bailed on Owens. He went to the back. They had a disagreement. And he said to Kevin on the way out, you know, the first time, let's see how well you do with without your guardian angel. So Owens ended up losing. He fell to the Kinshasa, gave Styles and Nakamura the win. Here's what I'm guessing happens. I'm guessing we get a screwy non-finish on Tuesday. Fastlane ends up being a triple threat match as they further tease a split between Owens and Zayn. And we get AJ Styles against Kevin Owens against Sami Zayn. Now, it's very similar to the Royal Rumble match, but this time Owens can pin Zayn to win the championship and vice versa. Zayn can pin Owens. Couldn't do that in a handicap match. So it actually is a different match, even though it feels the same. And on the Fastlane show, if they want to, they could also do Nakamura against Randy Orton. Now, I'm not a big fan of when the Royal Rumble winner puts his shot at the championship on the line the month or two before WrestleMania. That's stupid. It was always stupid to me. It was stupid when Shawn Michaels did it with Owen Hart back in 96. It's a dumb babyface move. They should not have Nakamura defending his Royal Rumble title shot. That should be safe and secure. But they could still do a match at Fastlane with him and Randy Orton. Now, Randy Orton's already beaten him, Nakamura's already beaten Orton once on TV. I think giving Randy Orton a win over him this time actually makes sense. Only if, here's the caveat, only if it sets up Orton to be his first challenger coming out of WrestleMania if we assume that Nakamura is winning the championship. Otherwise, to just have Randy Orton beat him and it doesn't lead to anything is stupid. I mean, look, I thought that's what they were doing with Austin and Triple H back in 2001. Coming out of WrestleMania 17 when they had Triple H pin Austin in that Three Stages of Hell match at No Way Out. And then, instead of pitting them against each other and Triple H going babyface, remember that night after WrestleMania when Triple H came out with the sledgehammer? Everybody cheered. Everybody thought he was going after McMahon and Austin, and they thought he was turning. And then what did he do? He hit The Rock in the head with the sledgehammer, and we had the two-man power trip. So, Triple H, smart dude. Sure, he had some influence at that point. He could see the tea leaves. He knew that, hey, Austin is the biggest star, and Austin just won the championship, and if we come out of WrestleMania and I'm challenging Austin for the title, I'm not getting that title, which means I gotta lose to Steve Austin. I would much rather team up with Steve Austin and be looked at as his equal. Smart guy, that Triple H. And it really left them in a lurch, too. There was no reason for it not to be Triple H, because Rock was going away to film a movie. They didn't have an obvious babyface to fill the role. That's why they needed Undertaker and Kane. You know, until Jericho and Benoit were ready for the spot, they had to go with Undertaker and Kane as the interim babyfaces to, you know, challenge Austin and Triple H, because they didn't have anybody else. It should have been Triple H in that role. Anyway, that's a different story, but... So Nakamura losing would not be the end of the world, as long as it leads to something. Owens and Zayn, if they do split up coming out of Fastlane, I mean, they could have a match at WrestleMania. Or they could keep them together and do the tag team match, and do Owens and Zayn against Shane McMahon and Daniel Bryan, which I admit is sounding and looking extremely unlikely with each passing week. That would still seem to be the most logical destination, based on what they've been doing with Bryan and Shane. I mean, short of a singles match between them doing a tag match against Owens and Zayn would still absolutely make sense as the ultimate climax to this feud, with Shane and Bryan winning. Now, when I was on Wade Keller's show the other day, and we were talking about this, as far as what do you do with AJ and Nakamura? You got to build to them at WrestleMania. So how do you build to a match between them? What should WWE be doing? And I know it's, again, very unlikely that they will do this, but I really think it's a mistake for WWE not to draw some attention, or at least make mention, of the fact that these guys have crossed paths before. This is not their first time going one-on-one. They had a very big match at Wrestle Kingdom a few years ago in New Japan. I know WWE doesn't really talk about... It's such a weird thing because they don't talk about New Japan. You never hear them mention the words New Japan, or very rarely if they do. But they have no problem mentioning that so-and-so was an IWGP champion, and it's just such a weird thing. There's no real rules, it seems like, as far as who you can mention, who you can't mention. It's just, I find the whole thing so stupid, you know what I mean? So, understanding that that's just sort of the mentality in that company, I think it's a mistake to not draw attention to the fact that these two have wrestled before, and where Nakamura comes from. Even if they just show still shots, and they credit Pro Wrestling Illustrated, which they do in all these DVD documentaries they do, they have no problem running still shots from other promotions and crediting PWI. Well, put together a nice video package going into WrestleMania and start making mention of the fact that Nakamura was a big, big star in Japan. Show photos from some of his matches, including the one he had with AJ, which he won. You know, he beat AJ in that match. Nakamura gave all of that up. He gave all of that fame up, all of the money, all the success that he had in Japan. He was one of the top three or four guys in New Japan Pro Wrestling. It would be the equivalent of somebody like a Randy Orton, okay? Or I'm trying to think of somebody else who would be like top, I guess an AJ, okay? Leaving WWE to go somewhere else. That's what that was like. And it was a wing and a prayer, because there's never been another Japanese star who has come over the way that he has and been in the position that he's in. He's already number one, whether he wins the championship at WrestleMania or not. The guy won the Royal Rumble match and is going to one of the main events at WrestleMania. He's already succeeded. There's never been another Japanese star, especially one as big as he was, who's come over and who has done that in WWE. But if I'm WWE, I don't know why you wouldn't want to tell that story. This guy left everything behind in Japan. He wanted to be a star in this company. That makes WWE feel like the biggest company in the world, which they are, the biggest company in the world. Bigger than New Japan, bigger than anybody else. Why wouldn't you want to stroke your own ego? They love doing that. Are you kidding me? They stroke their own ego every week. So here's a situation where mentioning another company, even if you just briefly sort of, you know, mention it, it just makes WWE look like a bigger deal. I want them to bring up their history. I want them to bring up that first match in some way. Mention it. You don't have to dwell on it. Show a still photo, have AJ mention it in a promo. You know, I owe you one. You know, you got one over me and I never forgot that. Like, I want that to be part of the build up to this match. And it's not such a far-fetched idea. If I'm Vince McMahon, it just makes my company feel like a bigger deal that this guy left where he was and all of that success for what wasn't a sure thing. 50-50 that this guy was going to have success and get over here the way that he has. He gave all of that up to take this big risk to come here. English is not his first language. But he wanted to be a WWE superstar. He wanted to prove it to himself that he could do it, and he did it. This is great video up on WWE.com of his reaction backstage after he won the Rumble. And it's just him looking into the camera being like, I did it. And he's smiling. He almost looks like he's crying. He looks genuinely emotional over the fact that he won that Royal Rumble match. That's what they should be playing up. That's a great story. And it gives AJ Styles that much more of a reason, besides not wanting to lose his championship. He has this loss that he wants to avenge. So, I'd like to see them focus on that at least a little bit. Very quickly here, 205 Live does have a new general manager. It is Rockstar Spud, which was my pick for who the GM would be. He is the new GM under a new name, and he is no longer Spud. He is now Drake Maverick. Sounds like something that came straight out of a porn name generator, but there you have it. He got a decent reaction. He got some Spud chants when he came out. I thought they were smart to send Daniel Bryan out there with him at the start of 205 Live to make the introduction. And I think it's a great spot for him to be in. You know, he was entertaining in a similar role in TNA as Dixie Carter's chief of staff. You know, it's funny. I still get emails asking me, when is WWE going to finally buy TNA and just be done with it? They kind of already did, right? They don't even have to at this point, other than the tape library, I guess, but they kind of already have. The big names they had left from the old guard were Kurt Angle, Sting, and the Hardys, and they got all three of them, or four of them, I guess. They got Samoa Joe, they got Bobby Roode, they got Eric Young, they got Spud, they got EC3, they got Jeremy Borash. They're probably getting Bobby Lashley back. It's like, and by the way, with Borash, I can't like emphasize this enough. For God's sakes, when you've lost Borash, I think that says a lot. I mean, hell, one of the biggest names still on the Impact roster, Alberto El Patron, is out there openly talking about wanting to come back to WWE. Like it's a foregone conclusion. Yeah, I'm going back. Of course I'm going back. They basically already bought Impact. It's been like a slow coup, but that's what they've done. What else do they need? The six-sided ring that's now sitting in storage? The barbed wire Christmas tree? It's the tape library. That's really the only thing left to get. And believe me, within a few years, I have no doubt that TNA Wrestling will be a section, probably under the vault, on the WWE Network. And then their mission will be complete. But they don't need to buy anything other than the library. They already have all of their talent. Drew Galloway, I forgot to mention him too. Throw him on the list too. Anyway, Maverick announced a 16-man elimination tournament to determine a new cruiserweight champion, with the finals taking place on the WrestleMania kickoff show. Well, he didn't say the kickoff show, but let's be honest, you know exactly that's where it's going to end up. And not on the DVD, I'm sure. Cedric Alexander pinned Grand Metalik, and TJP pinned Tyler Bate with a fistful of trunks in the first two matches of the tournament to advance. Not a good week for Tyler Bate. Two matches, two losses on TV this week. This Tuesday, in the next two tournament matches, it's Kalisto against Lindsay Dorado and Hideo Itami against Roderick Strong, making his 205 Live debut. Itami and Strong, I think, should be nice and snug. That could be a fun match to watch. Speaking of fun, Mixed Match Challenge Week 3. We had Braun Strowman and Alexa Bliss against Sami Zayn and Becky Lynch. Now, this was the third week. The live stream viewership continues to drop. They're doing okay on the back end, I guess, after the fact. You know, they're building more traffic, sort of taped, I guess you could say, than live. People aren't watching as much live now. First week, though, the live stream peaked at 130,000. Second week, it peaked at 90,000. This week, I saw it topped out around 60,000, maybe 61. But again, not everybody watches live. I really enjoyed the match this week. I really did. I thought Sami Zayn was really funny. He was running away from Braun Strowman throughout the match. Strowman press slammed him over the barricade at one point, literally just dumped him onto the concrete floor. And then for whatever reason, Strowman looks back. I don't know if somebody gave him a cue and said, quick, we got to go home or what the deal was, but he looks back at the ring and he felt the need to rush back into the ring. Like he was Kiefer Sutherland realizing a bomb was about to detonate. And in rushing back into the ring, Braun got tripped up in the ropes and everybody laughed at him, which is a terrible position for somebody like him to be in, to be pointed and mocked like that, but it was hard not to laugh at him. He tagged in Alexa Bliss. Alexa stood up on his shoulders and did the Twisted Bliss from his shoulders down onto Becky Lynch for the win. That was cool. Strowman puts Bliss up after the match on his shoulder. She's sitting on his shoulder like Macho Man used to do with Elizabeth. Renee Young gets into the ring to interview them, and there was some weird sexual tension going on here between Alexa Bliss and Braun Strowman. It was actually pretty entertaining. Braun said that he thought Alexa was cute. Alexa then said that she thought Braun was cute, and the crowd popped big for that. You're like a big Mack truck, she said, but with a big smiley face on the front. And she then told Braun, we're going all the way, which led to a yes chant from the crowd. She quickly clarified that she meant that they're going all the way in the tournament, and people booed. By this point, people didn't care about the tournament, they just wanted something else, I think. The fans started an all-the-way chant. She and Braun then did Braun's primal scream together to end the show. I just thought it was a really fun episode, which I think is all the show is supposed to be. It's meant to be fun. You know, and you could tell when they're out there, they're just out there having fun, kind of goofing off. Afterwards, in their first post-match interview on YouTube, Sammy and Becky, they're trying to figure out why we lost. Why did we lose? And Sammy decided it had to be the cake. Sammy had bought Becky a birthday cake. This was her birthday. He said, I made the mistake of buying this cake from a local baker here in Philly, which is probably why we lost. And as he's saying this, Becky is corpsing so hard on camera. She is doing everything in her power not to laugh. This was almost as good, almost, not quite, but almost as good as Mean Gene trying his hardest not to bust a gut laughing during an old Ken Patera promo. That one is still, to me, it just kind of stands above the rest. You just go on YouTube, type in Ken Patera murders a promo, and you'll find it. It'll come right up. There might be a few different versions of it. So this week, it's Jimmy Uso and Naomi against Goldust and Mandy Rose. They call themselves Rose Gold. Mandy is the replacement for Alicia Fox, who broke her tailbone working out in the ring before one of the shows. It actually might have been before the Rumble. So think about how crappy she must have felt to not be able to be part of that Royal Rumble match. I'm kind of wondering who took her spot. I guess we'll never know. But she's going to be out for a while, and so with injury comes opportunity. From their one little promo that they shot here on this show, they showed a very quick promo with Goldust and Mandy Rose. I think the two of them might make a great combination on TV, like on the main roster in the future. I like the whole Rose Gold thing. And look, they're not doing anything serious with Goldust at the moment. They started to when he was feuding with R-Truth, but then they just dropped it. Remember, we got the old Goldust back? Everyone's like, oh, he looks great. The old Goldust is back. And then, nothing. If they did something with him as a heel, she'd make a great valet for him. But like a valet who can actually go. I mean, she shouldn't just be eye candy. She can wrestle. You know, she's an athlete. She can get physical. She can kick people's ass, and he could even be in her corner for some of her matches. So let's see how they do this week. We haven't seen the match yet. We'll see what the chemistry is there between them. But I like the idea of putting the two of them together when that Absolution thing runs its course. So, as promised, we have 68 of you by virtue of your win in the Royal Rumble pool. You have now been entered into the Ultimate Rumble pool. This is the grand finale here. It's like Survivor Series 1990 all over again. The way this works is I'm going to pick three winners right here and now, live on the show. I am using the trusty list randomizer on the website random.org/lists. So you can go there and see exactly what I'm using for this. I have all 68 names listed line by line. I will paste it in. I will click the randomize button. It will then shake up all the names, so I'm having my own little superstar shakeup here, and it will spit them back out at me in a numbered list. And since it was lucky number 14 that won the Royal Rumble this year, I will choose whoever is listed at number 14 as the third place winner. I will then do the exact same thing, and whoever comes out number 14 will be the second place winner. And I will do it one last time, and whoever ends up number 14 will be our first place winner and the Ultimate Rumble pooler for 2018. Now, very quickly here, I mentioned prizes. Third place winner gets a $25 gift card to Pro Wrestling Tees. That's donated by Ron Falcon. Now, all these people who are donating, they are responsible for the prizes. I am not. So, if Ron says he's going to donate a $25 gift card to the third place winner, it's on Ron to make sure that gift card gets to the third place winner. And by the way, if you are a winner, you can get your information to me. Just be aware that if you want these items are coming from these individuals. So, as long as you're comfortable, or give me an address or a P.O. box or something that you're comfortable sharing, and we'll make sure that this gets to you. But that is what the third place winner will get. The second place winner gets any WWE shirt of your choosing from WWEshop.com. That's donated by Zach Holker, the man himself who put this whole thing together. And the first place winner will receive a whole bunch of things. The first place winner will get any two shirts of your choice from Pro Wrestling Tees. That's donated by Julian Cannon. You will also get a free sound-off shirt of your choosing from me. You just let me know what shirt you want, size, where to send it. And Alvin Siegertz in the Facebook group has put together a box of random wrestling items that he will send to the first place winner as well. He sent me a partial list of what's inside. And this is kind of crazy here. I mean, this really is just a mishmash of different items. So, for example, he will include in this box, I don't know how big this box is going to be, a Nintendo 64 game console with one controller, with the WCW NWO World Tour game, the WCW Mayhem game, There's a bunch of games he's throwing in there. Even WWE 2K15 for PS4. He'll throw that in there. The Sting 3-disc Into the Light DVD. That will be in there as well. There is a People's Elbow pad from The Rock. They used to sell those many years ago. I think I have one laying around here somewhere. That'll be in there. The first 4 volumes of WWF The Music on CD. Yes, these things called CDs that used to exist. Those will be in there as well. So it's just this sort of random, I almost use the word classic here, box of classic wrestling, memorabilia. But you'll get that as well, if you want it. Alvin will be more than happy to ship that off to you. So, without any further ado, shall we get moving here and kick this thing off? We are now going to choose the third place winner in the Royal Rumble pool. Let's get a little drum roll going here. The third place winner is Lennon Bernal. Lennon Bernal is our third place winner in the Royal Rumble pool. So Ron, Falcon, if you're listening out there, I guess get in touch with me. I'll try to put you in touch with Lennon, and you can get him his gift card. So congratulations to Lennon for being our third place winner. And so now what we will do is we are going to shake this up one more time as we search for a second place winner here in the Royal Rumble pool for 2018. And the second place winner in the pool is James A. Biggs. James Biggs, you are number 2 in our Ultimate Rumble pool. And so you will win the WWE shirt, I believe, from Zach as the second place prize. And Zach, James, both of you can touch base either with me or with each other. And we'll make sure that gets out to you. So congratulations to James. And now we come to the number 1 winner. This person here will be our first place winner in the Rumble pool. He's got a whole ton of stuff coming to him or her. And you will be the Ultimate Rumble Pooler for 2018. So exciting. Who's it going to be? Who is it going to be? Let's find out right now. Drum roll. The winner of the Ultimate Royal Rumble Pool for 2018 is Derek Gibbs. Derek Gibbs, you are the Ultimate Rumble Pooler and our first place winner here for 2018. Derek actually has been a longtime listener of this podcast, so I'm very happy to see him pick up the win here. So congratulations to Derek. Again, touch base with me and we'll make sure that we put you in touch with the right people. And you can let me know what Sound Off shirt you want and I'll be more than happy to pay to have that sent out to you. So again, congratulations to Derek. Congratulations to all of the winners. And at the end of the day, it's all about just having fun. And the response this year was tremendous. And hopefully we'll have an even bigger response next year when we bring you Rumble Pool number 6. It's like pay-per-views at this point. We'll have to come up with subtitles for these things. And again, thank you to Zach for all your help in putting this together. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate all the hard work that you put into this.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
I did not read the NXT spoilers from the tapings at Center Stage in Atlanta this week. They did 2 nights of tapings. I know that there were some big developments. I do know Ricochet made his in-ring debut under that name, so thank God he kept the name. The only other thing I know is that they are bringing back the Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic, and it will more than likely culminate at the TakeOver show over WrestleMania weekend in New Orleans. I don't know that that's been confirmed, but that is the belief. And if so, that would make 2 tournaments climaxing that weekend for WWE, the Dusty Classic and the Cruiserweight Tournament at WrestleMania. This week's show was mostly a bunch of video packages recapping the TakeOver show last weekend, but wedged in there was an awesome main event between Roderick Strong and Tyler Bate to determine a new number 1 contender for Pete Dunne's United Kingdom Championship. Both Bate and Strong are also in the Cruiserweight Tournament. Bate already lost. He's been eliminated. He lost to TJP. Strong makes his 205 Live debut this week against Hideo Itami, which sounds like a hell of a main event, assuming they put them on last. These matches were taped in Philly before TakeOver. We had Nikki Cross pinning Lacey Evans with a swinging fisherman's neckbreaker. I, for one, think that they should name more moves after different occupations. right? So we already have the Dr. Bomb, and we have the Fireman's Carry, maybe the Baker's Backbreaker, or the Coal Miner Clothesline, or maybe the Meter Maid Moonsault. That could be a good one. In honor of Enzo Amore, instead of a clothesline, we could call it the Unemployment Line, right? I mean, we could come up with a whole bunch of them. TM61 made their in-ring return. They are the Mighty, they told the backstage bot later on. The Mighty Don't Kneel, which of course was their name before coming to WWE. They beat the Ely Twins with their Thunder Valley finish, which is the double team press slam. That video series they did on TM61 to build to their return was very smart. They showed more personality in that than they did their entire run when they first came to NXT. I think it was before Shane's injury, I think it was. Some more personality from those guys, I think, is what they need, and it's going to go a long way, because in the ring, they're already, I think, at a high level. But, you know, it takes more than just having good matches. I mean, you have to either be somebody people like and can get behind, or, you know, good speakers. There just was nothing really interesting about them, and now it feels like they've finally turned a corner, so hopefully they'll find more success the second time around. Main event was Roddy against Tyler Bate, number one contenders match for the UK title. This was excellent. It was Backbreaker City from Roddy. Roddy also busted out a most unique stretch during the match. I'm not even sure. I'm sure it has a name, but I'm not sure what you would call it. It's kind of like a backbreaker in its own way, where he had Bate. Now picture a crucifix position, okay, where the guy is behind you, only Bate was facing outward towards the crowd. Roddy had his arms hooked, and he just bent forward and stretched him right across his back. It looked painful. All of Roddy's stuff looks painful, I mean, which is why I like the guy. He just comes across, and this is a little bit of the TM61 issue, right? Because it comes down to personality. The thing about Roderick Strong, he comes across as very dull to me when it comes to pretty much everything else. Like, his in-ring stuff is crisp and good, and he's probably one of the best they have. Personality-wise, he may be one of the worst. And his stuff in the ring looks as stiff as anybody in that company. Now, forget NXT. Anybody in the company. His stuff is as stiff as anybody in that company, except maybe Brock Lesnar. He doesn't have Lesnar's size, but his stuff looks believable. His chops are lethal, and we really haven't seen him utilize those too much yet in NXT. Those Ring of Honor matches where he would just chop the ever-loving shit out of people, he's really good. He's just missing something personality-wise. So anyway, he worked over the back so much when Bate finally went for Tyler Driver 97. Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. He grabbed his lower back. Couldn't do it. And Roddy finally hit the release standing suplex, where he basically just suplexes and throws the guy up into the air. And he landed right on Roddy's knees for the final backbreaker. Got the pin. So Roderick Strong now we get against Pete Dunne. I think between all of the chops and the backbreakers from Roddy and the bending of the fingers and the joint manipulation that the announcers love to talk about when it comes to Pete Dunne, my body already hurts, and I have not even seen this match yet, but I am looking forward to it. Let's get to your mailbag questions. Getting kind of late here on Super Bowl Sunday. I know a lot of you are watching the game, and of course, probably the other half of you don't give a crap because you don't live in this country and you watch a different kind of football. And then there's probably like the 10 or 15% of you who pretend to give a shit for one day about football and go, you know, buy snacks and everything. And that's cool too. But if you have questions, you could email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We'll start here with, let's see, Ryan from Colorado. What do you think about Asuka challenging Ronda Rousey at WrestleMania? You could build up to Asuka making her decision of which champion to face at the next pay-per-view. But instead of saying Alexa or Charlotte, she says, I want Ronda. I think it would be a great match to build to, and you could save, or rather you could have Nia and Becky challenge for their respective, boy, that's easy for me to say, isn't it? Their respective brands championships. You know I'm going for 2 hours when I start stumbling over my words. I hate that it would make both titles feel like they're beneath Rousey. That's why I don't like that idea. I've had people suggest to me they do that in the past with The Undertaker, right? Instead of having the Royal Rumble winner go after a championship, be like, hey, there's no bigger match than wrestling The Undertaker, so I want the dead man. I would rather they stick with having the winner challenge the champion. Like, don't start breaking the rules here. Asuka against Rousey is going to be a big match. I talked about this earlier in the podcast here. if they could save it somehow until next year's WrestleMania, I think that's the place to do it. And in the months to come, you can do Rousey and Charlotte, or you could do Rousey and Sasha, but eventually build to her and Asuka for the championship. But to do it at WrestleMania this year, I think is far too soon. I don't think it makes sense to rush into that match. There's no rush. You have her under contract. She's full-time, right? Whatever that means. Why would you rush that match? Asuka gets a title shot. You're not putting the title on Ronda before WrestleMania. That would be dumb. So I think you hold off on that match, and having her in the mixed tag match the first time out makes a lot of sense. Dick from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Given that Roman is going to be the challenger for Brock at WrestleMania and will walk out the champion, along with the general malaise with Paul Heyman's promos as Brock's advocate now for the last many months, do you think the time is drawing near for WWE to break them up, possibly even as part of a double turn where Heyman screws Lesnar to become Roman's manager during their inevitable title rematch after WrestleMania? Back in 2015, Heyman cut a promo on Raw where all he did was talk up Roman Reigns, and he said Roman was better than Hogan and Savage and Michaels and even Austin ever were in their prime. Almost as though Heyman back then wanted Roman as a client. I'm just thinking that the seeds had been planted for Heyman to turn on Brock, and that split could be used to fuel programs where Heyman is constantly looking for other guys to join him and Roman and have them take out Brock for good so that Heyman doesn't get his ass kicked by the Beast. Which is basically what Heyman did back in 2002, what you just described, only he had Big Show as his new client. First of all, they should never be split up. Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman should never, ever be split up. They did this once before. It was a mistake back then. It would be a mistake now. Now, if Roman wins the championship from Brock on his own, why would he even need Heyman? Although I guess in your scenario, you're saying Heyman would help him win. But you're also assuming there's going to be a rematch between the two of them after WrestleMania. I'm not so sure there will be a rematch, right? Goldberg never got his rematch. So when it comes to Brock, who doesn't wrestle all the time, I don't know that there is going to be a rematch. But like I said before, Heyman and Lesnar were broken up once. It was a mistake. It should never happen again. If Brock leaves, if Brock says, this is it for me after WrestleMania, I don't know when his contract is up. It's either WrestleMania or SummerSlam. But let's say this is going to be it, right? He wants to go back to UFC and fight again, and Mania is either his last match or one of his last matches, and Brock's going to walk away. That doesn't mean that you have to split him and Heyman up like Heyman betrays him or he beats up Paul on the way out. You don't have to do that. Heyman, I mean, Lesnar could leave if he wants, and probably one day he'll come back again when he realizes that he can't fight anymore and I need some money. And boy, I can really make a lot of money by just wrestling 4 or 5 times a year. Believe me, if he leaves, he'll end up coming back to WWE, and I'm sure Vince will welcome him back with open arms. He might even look at it and say, you know what, yeah, let's lose Brock for a year, maybe two, freshen things up. It could be good, and then we'll bring him back. So if Brock leaves, you don't have to split them up where one turns on the other. If you want to keep Heyman and not get rid of him as well because you see him as being a valuable asset, right, then you can have him find the new man. And I don't think that new man is Roman Reigns. I don't like that idea. There was a time when I liked that idea, but I feel like at this point, there's no reason to. It would just feel forced. I think for Roman Reigns to suddenly feel like I, you know, need to be with Paul Heyman after all these years and all the matches he's won on his own, I don't know. It's kind of like Austin and McMahon in 2001. Right? They did the big swerve, and even Austin now looks back and says, boy, that was a mistake. If I could go back and take that back, I would. It was just kind of foolish. Like, why would Austin, the biggest star in the business, and all the times he stunned Vince and beat Vince up, and all the big names he's beaten on his own, why does he feel he needs Vince McMahon all of a sudden? I mean, in the context of that one night, it kind of made sense that he was so driven by winning the championship that one night. But what the real Austin would have done was he would have had Vince's help, beaten Rock, and then said, thanks, Vince, fuck you. And then he would have dropped him with a stunner because he got what he wanted. That's what should have happened. Even Austin says, I wish that when I shook Vince's hand, I would have kicked him in the gut and dropped him. That would have made more sense. Because why does Austin need Vince? I kind of feel that way about Roman and Heyman. I think Heyman could benefit a lot of different people. You know what? He doesn't need to be with Roman. I hear Bobby Lashley maybe coming into WWE. So if Brock is going to, and actually the rumor is that it might be Brock against Lashley after WrestleMania, which would be interesting. And another reason why I would absolutely not break up Heyman and Lesnar. If you're going to do Lesnar and Lashley, Lesnar still needs a mouthpiece here. There's no one better that you're going to find for him than Paul Heyman. Okay, even though I'm kind of tired of a lot of his recent promos, as a pair, the two of them, I mean, they're inseparable. You just can't break them up. But if Brock goes, maybe you put Heyman with Lashley. Maybe he hitches his wagon to Bobby Lashley and he can be a mouthpiece for Bobby if he comes back. But no, I would not break up Heyman and Lesnar. No matter what, even if Brock leaves the company, I would not have him turn on Brock because Brock's going to be back. And I just feel like as long as Brock is in this company, he needs Heyman as his second. He needs Heyman as his mouthpiece. Brock can't do it on his own. He needs somebody to talk for him. Heyman is that guy. You split them up, you then have to find a way to get them back together. And why in God's name, after the second time that this man has turned on Brock, would Brock want this guy back? It just doesn't make sense. I wouldn't split them up. Rick from Tacoma, Washington, assuming that Elias has a non-wrestling role at WrestleMania, which would you prefer? Elias interrupts a Kid Rock musical performance. Yes. Could end the question there. Yes, please. He interrupts Kid Rock. Period. The end. No. He says, interrupts a Kid Rock musical performance and shits on the entire Hall of Fame class, ending with him being squashed by Goldberg, or would you prefer an Elias concert interrupted by Dwayne Johnson's Rock concert? Well, you know, if Rock can't wrestle, if he can be there but he can't wrestle, I'm down for dueling concerts with him and Elias. I like that idea. I actually do. I like that. I think that could be a moment. That'd be a big moment for Elias. Of course, it would end with Elias eating a Rock bottom. But I think that could be a lot of fun. Now, if Rock can wrestle, then you got to tag him up with Ronda because there's no other match really for him. And you could go the Goldberg route. That's okay, too. Have him get speared to end the segment. There's going to be people who don't like that because in both scenarios, all the old guy's laying out the new guy and he's burying Elias. Of course, that's completely ridiculous. I mean, it's like what they did with the Revival, you know, at Raw 25. You could see that coming from a mile away and people were like, oh, that's it. Revival's buried. The shovel is out. And I just shake my head like, come on. Could you not see what they were going for here? And what happened at the Rumble? They got their win back. 50-50 bullshit. You could see this coming from a mile away. So believe me, if Elias does some kind of segment at WrestleMania that involves The Rock, or that involves Goldberg doing a spear or something, everybody cheers, everybody's happy. It's a big spot for Elias. It does no harm to him whatsoever. If anything, it only makes him feel like that much of a bigger deal that he would even be associated with somebody like The Rock. Or like Goldberg, who is a much bigger star than he is. Mikey writes in, what do you think of the New Japan Strong Style event selling out in 20 minutes? Do you think it's possible for them to go for a 10,000-seat venue in this country? Well, the venue they're running, my understanding is the venue seats a little more than 5,000. I don't know that they sold 5,000 tickets. It might be a little less, like with the staging and everything. But it's a 5,000-seater. I believe, right? The pyramid, I think it's called. So do I think that they could sell out a 10,000 seat building in the US? You bet your ass I do. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think they could easily do double what they did for this show. It's just a matter of finding the right city. I think it would have to be a city in California. I think New York, Chicago, someplace like that would make the most sense and give them the best shot. But do I think New Japan could fill a building that big? Do I think New Japan could fill a building potentially larger than 10,000 seats? Right now, yes, I do. I really do. And it's almost like they keep, I don't know if they're being too modest or what the word is for it, that they didn't try running a bigger building this time. They're almost being too conservative, I think. They could be, I don't say risky, but, you know, come on. You got a lot of buzz around you right now. Business for them is booming. They're doing very well. Apparently the show on Access Television is doing very well here in this country. Yeah, you put them in a building that seats 13,000? You know what? I can't guarantee you they'd fill that, but I think they'd have a shot at filling most of that. I really do. Tay from DC. I remember a few years ago you got a question about whether steroids impacted the wrestling business or Major League Baseball more, and you said wrestling. I agree, but I'd like to point out a few more things on the subject, such as how both baseball and WWE benefited off their performers using steroids and how they only cracked down on usage after the government got involved. In the wake of Barry Bonds being denied entry into the Hall of Fame for alleged steroid use, Right. Do you think WWE will ever deny guys entry into their Hall of Fame for using steroids? Well, I got news for you. If WWE was to deny people entry into their Hall of Fame for using steroids, there would be no Hall of Fame. You could just close the whole damn thing up because it doesn't exist. You think those Hall of Fame classes with Hulk Hogan and Paul Orndorff and Roddy Piper and all those guys, Billy Graham, you think those guys would be in the Hall of Fame if they had a strict policy of not admitting people who took steroids? Give me a fucking break. Right, and I'm not yelling at you, Tay. I'm just saying it's the concept of that is completely preposterous. And the other part of his question was, do you think that both organizations are hypocrites for waiting years to take this issue seriously when it no longer worked in their favor? Well, I mean, look, of course they're hypocrites. I mean, look, they turned a blind eye to it, especially in baseball. They knew what was going on. They knew what was going on. Those balls were flying out of the ballpark. People were piling into those stadiums. You think they didn't know what was going on? They're not stupid. Of course they're hypocrites. Everyone's a hypocrite. But the thing with wrestling is, it's not a real traditional Hall of Fame. There is, like with the Baseball Hall of Fame and other types of Halls of Fame, you have the sports writers who cast votes. Maybe you have the athletes themselves casting votes on their fellow athletes. But the WWE Hall of Fame, which I talked about earlier, it's a figment of one man's imagination, and whoever he wants in the Hall of Fame, whoever he's on good terms with, they may get into the Hall of Fame. There literally is no criteria for getting into the WWE Hall of Fame that, at least no criteria that has ever been explained publicly to all of us. It's up to one man. And you don't even have to have worked for WWE. They put people in the Hall of Fame who weren't even stars in WWE. Right? International stars. Maybe they wrestled once in Madison Square Garden back in the 70s or something, but so you can't even say, well, it's only limited to WWE people or it's only limited to people who were champions. Like, none of that is true. There is no criteria. Literally anybody could be in the Hall of Fame. But the idea that it's such a serious thing, like, we won't admit anybody into the Hall of Fame who took steroids. The one thing we do know, I guess you can say if there was any criteria, if there was, you could say that I guess if you did hardcore porn, you're not welcome in the Hall of Fame. Because that isn't that what Triple H said about China? You Google her name, you're going to find a lot of salacious stuff. And everybody threw in his face about Sean Waltman and how hypocritical that was of him to say. And of course, Waltman's his buddy. To be fair, though, Waltman also didn't do hardcore porn. And if he did, I certainly have no interest in seeing it. But that was his argument at the time for why it would be very difficult to put China in. Meanwhile, they've never shut the door. I think even Stephanie McMahon herself has said that, like, one day it's going to happen. So what does that mean? Like, their one criteria, according to Triple H, apparently isn't even rock solid. And one of these years, China probably will end up in the Hall of Fame. So again, it's whichever way the wind blows, and it's up ultimately to Vince McMahon. But the idea that Vince McMahon, of all people, suddenly finds religion and says, oh, I can't put anybody in the Hall of Fame who ever did steroids. It's so comical to me. I can't even take that seriously. That's just not the kind of Hall of Fame that this is. His entire business. I can't say, like, the entire wrestling business, because that would be a little unfair to certain, like, wrestling in parts of the world. But especially in Vince's company under his command, like, his entire company, his entire boom in the 80s was built off the back of guys doing steroids and getting blown up like big freaks. That's how he made his millions of dollars. That's how he found his biggest stars. There were guys that estimated at the time 80, 90% of the locker room was doing steroids in some form or fashion. Among other things, they had a cocaine problem at one point. Drugs were rampant. I mean, when does it end? We had Vince talking about the XFL, the new XFL last week, and we're not going to allow anybody in with a criminal record, even if you had a DUI or whatever. You're not going to be welcome into the Hall of Fame. We don't, you know, we care about the character of the people. Boy, this is a very different Vince McMahon than the one who built his business 30 years ago. I'll say that much. Because if he followed those same standards back then, he wouldn't even have a company. He would have been out of business a long time ago. And Ben, from Norwich, England. As someone who also grew up loving 1992 and being from the UK, SummerSlam that year is a personal favorite of mine. I wanted to know if you had any information on what the original plans would have been for the show had it not been moved to Wembley Stadium from Washington, D.C. So, I wanted to use this question because I thought it was, I don't think I've ever talked about this. For those who don't know what Ben is referring to, Vince McMahon, back in 92, had it narrowed down to two locations for SummerSlam that year. It was either going to be in Washington, D.C., or it was going to be at Wembley Stadium in London, because I guess they were doing big business in the UK at the time. Bret Hart was going to drop the Intercontinental Championship on that show regardless, whether it was in the States or it was in the UK. He was losing that title no matter what. It was just a matter of to who. And as Bret tells the story, he pitched to drop it to Davey Boy if the show was in London. And if the show was in DC, he pitched to drop it to Shawn Michaels. And he would do it in a ladder match, which Bret has been very vociferous about in the past, is an idea that he doesn't get credited for. He invented it or brought it to WWE long before, you know, Shawn and Razor did it, which is true. In fact, Bret was involved in ladder matches going all the way back to the Stampede days, I think, with Dynamite Kid. But those are the ideas that Bret pitched. And in fact, they did something of a test run for this a month before SummerSlam, which is where that old ladder match happened with Bret and Shawn for the IC title in July of 1992, which is going to be available on the network starting tomorrow when they put those Coliseum videos up, smack 'em, whack 'em. Anyway, Vince ultimately decided, as we all know, on Wembley Stadium. We're going to go to the UK, we're going to run Wembley, they had 80,000 people there, it's going to be a big show. And so we got Bret against Bulldog and not Bret against Shawn. Shawn was programmed with Rick Martel instead. In kind of a random match. I'm not even sure they did much to build that match up, to be honest with you. And Shawn did end up getting the IC title. He beat Bulldog for it a few months later anyway, even if it was only because Bulldog was getting fired. I always suspected, and I have no way of knowing this. This has never been talked about by Vince McMahon, which is why the concept of Vince, I wish Vince would one day just sort of open up about all these little stories. I doubt he even has the memory, if he remembers any of this. And Vince is one of those guys, like, I don't even know that I would trust half of what he says if he ever did some kind of shoot interview. But he would be one of the few who would know. I mean, maybe Bruce Pritchard knows, but I suspect that what would have happened had Bulldog not been fired is that he would have been the IC champion probably going into WrestleMania 9, and Shawn Michaels would have won the championship from him at WrestleMania. So we know that it would have been Shawn and Bret in DC. As far as other matches, I don't know that they had an entire card mapped out had they ended up there. So this is all just fantasy booking from me from this point out. They could have stuck with Ultimate Warrior and Randy Savage, which was the other sort of double main event they did in the UK. That was the WWF title match. I think, you know, in DC, they probably would have headlined with that. The only reason they headlined with Bret and Bulldog was because they were in the UK. If they were in DC, Warrior and Savage go on last. And, you know, headlining with that match would have been tricky because they did this very unsatisfying count out finish to the match, which I guess they did the following year also at SummerSlam. But yeah, they had Ric Flair interfering and Mr. Perfect interfering, and Savage got counted out, I think, because he hurt his leg. It's like, it's one thing to do that in the middle of the card, but to end the show with that as the finish, I think would have been really disappointing. But I just don't see Warrior in his first big match back with the company doing a clean job to Randy Savage. Especially not if the plan was to get the belt back onto Ric Flair the very next month, right? Or putting the title on Warrior and then having him drop it to Flair. Forget about that. There's no way that was ever going to happen. So I wouldn't have done Warrior and Savage at all. I mean, we could all fantasy book our own cards if it were me. You know, Warrior was feuding with Papa Shango for most of the summer. They were trying to build Papa Shango up as like an upper mid-carder, almost like a main eventer. I mean, for God's sakes, the guy ran out during the main event of WrestleMania. It looked like they were setting something up with Warrior and Shango. So I would have just built that up some more, and I would have had Ultimate Warrior against Papa Shango at SummerSlam. It would have been an easy win for the Warrior. I mean, for God's sakes, it's his first pay-per-view back. You know, he didn't have to be in the championship match right away. You put him against Papa Shango. You do Brett against Shawn in a ladder match for the IC title. And Ric Flair gets his rematch with Randy Savage in the main event for the WWF title, maybe in a cage. That way you can keep out Mr. Perfect. I don't really know why Flair didn't have a match at SummerSlam that year. I know he had some kind of inner ear injury that Warrior gave him when they wrestled, but I was under the impression that injury came after SummerSlam, not before. I mean, if he's hurt, then what are you going to do? The guy's hurt, but if not, there was no excuse for Ric Flair not to be wrestling on that card at WrestleMania. And I've heard other rumors that, you know, Vince, it was punishment from Vince because Vince was still pissed at him for bleeding and blading at WrestleMania, which is a fact. And Flair even said when he came backstage at WrestleMania 8, he had this great match with Randy Savage. He was wearing the Crimson Mask, and Vince just said something to him to the effect of, you'll never learn, or something like that, that really was like a put down. He was really, really pissed. He didn't blame Brett for bleeding, because Brett was able to hide it and pretend like, oh, it was hard way. But Flair, I mean, it was pretty obvious that he had cut himself. And so it was punishment to Flair from Vince to keep him off SummerSlam. I think that's bullshit. I don't buy that. I really don't buy that. So there really was no reason for him not to have a match. And, you know, honestly, I know this was years before WWE started doing triple threat matches, but they really easily could have done a triple threat for the first time ever on that SummerSlam show with Warrior, Savage, and Flair. They could have done that too. I mean, all three had beef with each other, right? They were building tension between Warrior and Savage. Flair was stirring the pot, him imperfect. So a three-way would not have been so unbelievable, and Flair could have beat Savage for the belt so that Warrior doesn't have to take the fall. But, you know, back then we actually got singles matches, not multi-man matches on TV every single week. It's funny, the SummerSlam 92 is, it's a pretty unique show when you look back at it. It was that rare big show with no Hulk Hogan. In fact, that might have been the very first big, you know, one of the big pay-per-views of that entire era. I think since Hulkamania began, that Hogan was not on. The first one might have been SummerSlam 92. And there was no Hogan on that show, even though Hogan once made a song called Hulkster in Heaven about a sick kid he supposedly met the day before SummerSlam that year. He, as he tells the story, he got the kid a front row seat to SummerSlam. And the next day at the show, when he looked out into the crowd and he saw the empty seat, he knew what that meant. He knew that child had passed away. And this compelled him to write a song about it. Even though Hogan wasn't at the show that night, I don't even think he was in the country. It's like one of those great Hogan tales that has been told over the years. It's too bad bullshit doesn't have protein in it. Hogan's fed so much of it to us over the years. If it did, my arms would be as big as fucking Popeye right now. So, no Hogan. They were also, you know, running a big stadium in the UK for a major show, which wasn't something they had ever done before. And they haven't done a big show there since, like that. And they also had a bunch of heel, and this is the other unique thing about this show, is they had a bunch of heel against heel and face against face matches, which was very unusual for WWE at that time. They did heel against heel with Shawn Michaels against Rick Martel, and they did not one but two babyface matches, both main event matches on the show, Savage against Warrior, both were babyfaces, Bret Hart against the British Bulldog. Even though Bulldog was the de facto hometown hero, it's not like Bret got booed, I mean, he still got cheered. Two babyfaces. So there were a lot of very unique things about that year's SummerSlam. And we'll end with this. This was actually a post in our Facebook group from Curtis. He posted, I don't know if it was like a meme or something, but I wanted to expand on it here. I gave a very brief answer. He posted an image with Shawn Michaels, AJ Styles, Daniel Bryan, and CM Punk. And he asked the question, one has to go, along with all of their matches. Which one do you choose? And my answer was pretty easy. I basically said, sorry, Punk, but adios. And I just wanted to expand on that a little bit more here, because there were a lot of different answers in that thread. I thought it was kind of an interesting discussion. And part of it may just be, you know, how old you were when you started watching wrestling. You know, a lot of people started watching around the time of the pipe bomb with Punk. And so to them, he's like their big hero, and they would love nothing more than to see him come back, and he's like this big, big name to them. But for the rest of us, you know, we have a much larger body of work for these four to look back at. To me, Shawn Michaels and AJ Styles, I mean, those are two non-starters. So you're not picking either one of those guys. The impact that those guys have had on their respective companies, their body of work in terms of their matches, they're two of the best of all time. So you put them on the side. That leaves Daniel Bryan and CM Punk. It basically comes down to those two. Now, I went with Punk as the one who I would get rid of, along with all of his matches. One of the key reasons being that I've seen a lot of CM Punk matches, and I've seen a lot of Daniel Bryan matches. And to me, the Daniel Bryan matches far outweigh the CM Punk matches. Now, if promos and verbal talent, verbal ability is important to you, then yes, Punk has the edge over Bryan. But that's not enough. That's, to me, it's not enough to tip the scales in Punk's favor. You know, when I think back at the body of work that Bryan has had in WWE, when I think back to the body of work that he had in Ring of Honor, it far exceeds the body of work in the ring of CM Punk. And yes, Punk was, you know, he became this cult hero with the pipe bomb, and he was one of the better, more realistic promos in WWE for the time that he was there. He was better than, you know, a lot of other guys were on that roster. Daniel Bryan has never been the talker that CM Punk was, and he never will be. But Bryan also caught fire, naturally. The fans just naturally gravitated to him and sort of made him this big-time star that he never really had any right to be, the way, you know, WWE was pushing him. And so just naturally and organically, he turned into this big, big star in the company. So if you look at their overall body of work in terms of their star power, in terms of their matches, in terms of their promos, and just their overall impact, Punk definitely had an impact on the company and deserves credit, I think, for opening a lot of doors for indie talent and some smaller guys. Because Punk wasn't the biggest guy in the world. But I put him and Bryan on the same plane. I think CM Punk and Daniel Bryan both can be credited for the influx of indie talent that we have seen in WWE in recent years. And so I know a lot of you will curse them for that because you don't like all these indie stars coming in. Even though the majority, it's kind of a stupid label, I think, because a lot of the wrestlers, I would even say the vast majority of wrestlers who come in would have to be considered indie, because indie, I look at indie as, okay, they wrestled matches, you know, independently of WWE or any sort of, you know, big company. Most guys started somewhere, right? So technically everybody would be indie, unless you got, you know, churned out of the machine they have there at the Performance Center. But it was Punk and Bryan getting over when they did, and the way they did, that really opened a lot of eyes to people saying, wait a minute, maybe you don't have to be 6 foot two, 250 pounds. You know, and maybe coming from a Ring of Honor or a New Japan or some of these other promotions, maybe that's not such a bad thing. Maybe that's not, we don't have to sort of look past people like that. Maybe we need some people like that. They definitely opened a lot of doors, but I think they both, you can't just credit Punk for that. I think they both, Bryan too, in particular, I think deserves credit for opening doors for a lot of guys that otherwise would never have been opened. So their impact is pretty similar in that way, but Bryan's body of work in the ring just puts him way over the top. So, sorry, Punk, but I got to cut you loose. So that was my rationale for picking Punk as the one to go. But hey, chime in. Would love to hear from you guys. You got AJ, HBK, Punk, and Bryan. Who goes? Who stays and who goes? You got to pick one to go. And Punk would be my pick. Thank you to everybody who helped me blow past 25,000 followers last weekend on Twitter. I think we're even over 25,100 and counting. So thank you to everybody who's following me on there. At Solomonster is the place to go if you would like to follow my ramblings and any sort of breaking news that I comment on there. You could give this show a 5-star rating and a review in iTunes or Stitcher. We are a 5-star rated podcast, so your kind reviews are appreciated. We will be back with a brand new show, episode 534. That'll be next Sunday. And you can check out the Royal Rumble review, my full hour-long review of the pay-per-view from last weekend. It is up on YouTube, 680,000 visits and counting. So hopefully we can get that up to 700 before long. I'm still blown away by that. I don't expect that to happen ever again, but shit, I mean, that was something to see. I was not expecting that. And if you gave it a thumbs up, I thank you for that. Enjoy the Super Bowl if you're watching tonight. My prediction again, Patriots 28, Eagles 20. Sorry, Philly, but that's just the way it is. I can't vote against Tom Brady. Until next time, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, enjoy the big game, and we will see you back here for more Sound Off, as always, next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare?
I was driving yesterday and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane.
I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Monster Sounds Off. Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.